It's 9:04, October 3rd, 2016, and this is the National Liberty Alliance weekly Monday night call. Okay, John is still on the sick list. I gave him the night off. I think he's used maybe 2 of the 10 sick days I gave him when we started this, so he's got a couple left anyway. But he's doing better, but I thought it was too soon for him to come out, so I sequestered him for the night. Anyway, we're going to go ahead. I'm going to start with a Bible reading like we normally do, which I skipped last week because I came in kind of frazzled and late. But I think this week we'll do Psalm 139, which is one of the Psalms of David. Deliver me, O Lord, from the evil man. Rescue me from the unjust man, who have devised iniquities in their hearts. All day long they design battles, that they have sharpened their tongues. Like a serpent, the venom of the asp is under their lips. Keep me, O Lord, from the hand of the wicked. From the unjust man, deliver me. Who have proposed to supplicate my steps? The proud have hidden a net for me. They have stretched out cords for a snare. They have laid for me a stumbling block by the wayside. I say to the Lord, Thou art my God. Hear, O Lord, the voice of my supplication. O Lord, Lord, my strength of my salvation, Thou hast overshadowed my head in the day of battle. Give me not up, O Lord, from my desire to the wicked, for they have plotted against me. Do not thou forsake me, lest they should triumph. The head of them compassing me about, the labor of their lips shall overwhelm them. Burning coal shall fall upon them. Thou wilt cast them into the fire. In miseries they shall not be able to stand. A man full of tongue shall not be established in the earth. Evil shall catch the unjust man unto destruction. I know that the Lord will do justice to the needy and will revenge the poor. But as for the just, they shall give glory to thy name, and the upright shall dwell with thy countenance. Claire, can you shut that? Excuse me. Okay. Well, here we are in October already, and lots of things going on. For me, things seem to move faster and faster. I'm going to put us in lecture mode because... Okay, so I know that there's been some... talk about, September 29th, you know, we're past September 29th and nothing happened. Well, nothing was supposed to happen on September 29th that you could see. The September 29th day was the day that the special drawing rights went into effect, which means that that's the currency that the World Bank put in there. In other words, they're supplanting the United States dollar with this special drawing rights, which is a digital currency. And I don't know exactly what nations are on that. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is that the American dollar is not going to be accepted overseas, and that starts today. That started the 29th. Now, that's the virus going in. You're not going to feel that all at once. The corporations doing business overseas, which is most of them today because we don't make anything in this country, are going to have some problems, you know, trying to bring in goods and services if they can't use the American dollar. As people gradually figure out that the dollar is defunct and defaulted and they don't start accepting it anymore, that's the beginning of the end. So the 29th was the shot that put the virus in the system. I mean, it's been coming along because they've been printing money like a drunken, wanton sailor, and we knew that this would come. It was only a question of when, not if. And so it did come, and it is here. And there are some major banks sitting poised to fail. One of them is Deutsche Bank. There's a couple of them. And those banks, if they go, they will create a cascading default that cannot be stopped. And I don't believe that that's controllable even by the powers that be. It's like in the old Westerns when they when the stagecoach was coming down the path and they went up on the hills and they tried to catch the stagecoach down in the gulch, and they would get a big rock and poise it and wait for that stagecoach to come and then roll it down the hill, hoping to stop it or hit it. Well, once you let that rock go, there's no calling it back. You also can't control it. So if that stagecoach is not where it should be when you let it go, it's just too bad. It is what it is. And that's where we are now. That rock is rolling down the hill. They can't stop it. They have to deal with it. There are other things. There is a basket of currency that the BRICS nations have put up that is backed by gold. If America was smart, I believe that that's the one we should have went for, the backed by gold one. I think the SDR is just going to perpetuate the digital money so that the New World Order can come in. That's their creation. And in the meantime, you got all these factions fighting because the central banks are on their own now. The World Bank refused to bail them out after they gave them all the permission to go ahead and do what they did. Then they said, yeah, take care of it yourself. So you're going to see a lot of chaos, well, as they try to take care of it themselves. So how long we have before that becomes reality, I don't know. But we need to be out there trying to mitigate the circumstances. What's going to keep us, there's going to be a fire sale here with American dollars, I believe. I believe China's holding lots of American dollars that are worthless. I believe that our politicians, Obama and them and Hillary, have went over there and promised them that we would back the bad debt that we sold them, and we would back it with American collateral, coal, oil, uranium. That's what's going on out west. That's the land grabs. That's the American government. Well, it's not the American government. It's the American usurped government, the corporate overlay that, you know, and Russia and China are ready to break their legs, and they have to deliver. And one of the things we have going for us is we're Americans, and we're very armed. And a matter of fact, I had heard that that's one of the things that they told the president when he went over there, and he promised them that he would, you know, take care of them with our resources and our lands. And they said, that's nice, but we're going to tell you what the Japanese general told Emperor Hirohito when he said, why didn't you keep going into America? And he said, because there's going to be a gun behind every blade of grass. And that's a literal quote. That actually happened. And I'm sure that they told him the same thing. Now go home and get rid of the guns. And that's exactly what he did. He came here back and he had a vengeance on gun control. They all do. And there's a reason, because they can't take your homes and your businesses and your food and your stores and your life away if you're armed. Not very easily they can't. And so that's one big problem they have. And quite unfortunately for them, every time Obama opened his mouth about guns, another 250,000 of them hit the streets. Hence he has the title, the greatest gun salesman of the year, you see hanging in the gun shops. Well, that's where we're at, and you know, it's up to us to deal with each other and keep this country going. We have great resources here. We're going to have to start putting them back into online, and that's going to be a problem. And whatever we have is what we're going to be able to deal with. I think that there's also going to be a fire sale going on over here, because I think they're going to try to keep the Federal Reserve note and floating here long enough for those people that took the American debt, that are holding American dollars, to come over here and buy up whatever they can, because once those banks start failing the American dollar, you can paper your wall with it, and they know it. But in the meantime, they're going to come here and they're going to buy everything up. It's going to be a fire sale. And so look out for that. I see signs of it even in my own community. There's a lot of Chinese businesses going in, a lot of money being spent. And, you know, they're going to take that money and they're going to unload it. They may, some of you people may actually get offers on your property. And you're going to, and you're going to think that you made it big because there's going to be a bidding war and they're going to give you all kinds of money. And just about the time that the closings go through and you get your money and you think you're going to go on, you're going to retire or go here or go there, you're going to find out that that money's worth nothing. And so just be careful because that's where I think we're heading. And how long is that going to take? I don't have the right to say, but let me tell you what, it's going to happen. It's not a question. You know, we're the walking dead. The dollar is the walking dead, man. It's already dead. We just don't know it. Right now, there's things going on that the news media is not reporting. They're in the mode of pay no attention to the man behind the curtain type stuff. You know, I mean, we like last week or the week before, I think it was, there was 7 states that declared an emergency because there's something about a broken pipeline and there's not enough gas. I don't know if I believe that. You look at one, if they got to take money from overseas to bring the gas over, and some of those companies that are pumping the oil are not going to accept American dollars. It might have started last week. They might have had to come up with something else. And so really it's more about a shortage of them being able to clear the accounts to bring the gasoline over. And if it started before the 29th, which it naturally would, you know, there's no set date that everything moves by. If you think that there's a date to live and die by, guess what? You will die by it because it's in God's hand. You know, as far as I'm concerned, this is an alternate ending DVD, and the fact that we have free will alters the ending, and that's why it's up to us to alter the ending. You know, it depends on how many of us actually wake up and do the right thing. And hence, you know, we're pushing the committees of safety because all of our forefathers all were on a committee of safety, which most people don't even know anything about that, which is an assembly of people in their local areas meeting to work out problems. Problems from whom? Problems from the usurper. So that's where we're at, and that's what we need to do. You know, we need to get back to the Constitution, to the original Constitution. We need to reinstitute that, and we need to have our juries, our petit juries and our grand juries, and when they need to be free and unfettered. And we found so many things wrong with what they've been doing. I mean, things that deserve, you know, indictment and prosecution. You know, federal grand juries books that tell the jury that you're only allowed to rule on the law, and you're going to rule on the law as the judge gives it to you, and that if you come to an indictment, but the federal prosecutor doesn't sign it, the indictment doesn't go, and that's a safety valve. Imagine that. Who put that book out? Where is that in history? That's a blatant lie. That is treason right there. That's jury tampering right there. Whoever published that book and put it in there needs to be taken to task, you know. And I don't know where that book came from or who published it or what. That was a federal grand jury jury instruction book. And for all I know, George Soros had them printed up and dropped off, and them people there, not knowing any better, just passed them out. But these are the things that are in our court. These lies. This is what we suffer from every day. And so this is what your education is about, the civics course, the constitutional course. People don't. You should know that you have the right of jury nullification, the right to say no, that the law is no good. I don't care. You know, they want you to be a machine. Oh, you're going to rule on whether the law was broken or not, and that's all you're going to rule. Did he do it or didn't he do it? Never mind what the circumstances were. They want automen. They want statutes. They want little square pegs to line up little square holes in their IBM cards. They want this Babylonian law to rule us because that's how they make their money. It's all about making money. When you got people that could use their common sense and they could deliberate, you can't make money. No injured party, no crime. And if we're actually going to talk about a crime, guess what? That takes too much time. Let's get it over with. Slap the gavel down. Pay your money. Get out of here. So it's we're coming very, very close. And you have to be able to read between the lines and behind the lines. The news media is managed. My goodness, Rupert Murdoch owns almost all of them. And Obama has a family member on every single major media outlet. What do you think you're listening to on that boob tube? It's called programming for a reason. They're programming you. And they're going to keep you calm. And they want you to think everything's all right. And believe me, you know, they're not ready for chaos. They may want chaos. And I believe the factions on the top, they have a couple of different agendas. And there is some fighting. And we see some encouraging stuff going on. There's been some encouraging things coming, you know, things in the news and things in cases that are, you know, show that they are suffering the death of a thousand cuts, that the light is going off in people's minds and they are educating themselves and they are asking questions. And what that does is the public officials that are up there that are now looking at things and they're not, if they're not completely controlled, those are the ones that are going to come around and start doing the right thing, because they're going to realize that the game is up and they got to start doing it, because we're going to hold them accountable otherwise. So, you know, there's plenty of things going on all over, you know, and just some of the stuff that has happened in the case in Oregon and the trial over there, and things are not going quite the way the government wanted them to go. They could be going better, but they also didn't plan on anything coming out, and they've been caught with their hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. You know, prompting the witnesses, the federal prosecutors prompting the witnesses in different other stories they got caught doing. And, you know, I also heard that the charges were dropped against Shauna Cox about carrying a gun. So they're starting to do damage control. They wanted to drag this thing out as long as they could to try to get as many plea bargains as they can, you know, as they could, in order to not have to give everybody, you know, off. But that's up to us to make sure everybody gets off on that thing. You know, the whole business of whether the government can own the land or not, this is a big, big issue. And I remember when Ammon's attorney said that he was going to just fight on one thing, and that is the thing that they're not allowed to own these places, and that particular, the state that they were in, didn't give it to them, only allowed them to operate there, and that they couldn't kick the people off, and that there actually was a clause for adverse possession, which the takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge would be, but also the Nevada one. So if the federal government never gave the land to the federal government, then their whole case falls down. And I said when he said that, I said, I'm surprised he's going there, because we know they're not allowed to own the land, that once it's a state, it has to be turned over to the people. And I said, you know, if he gets, my prediction was that if he got any traction, they would pull him off it. Well, that's exactly what happened. And he pulled himself off and said he needs to go to somebody who knows more about this stuff. That's because he found out these things and they know it now. What are they going to do about it? And the more we put stuff out there and we put stuff in the courts, the latest paper that we put in to all the courts is an actual paper that we're going to get an index number on. We're waiting for the number to come. But that, once we get that number, and it was sent out last week, we're waiting for, you know, we got the green card back that they got it, because we filed, you know, through the mail. Once we get that, we're going to be able to put these papers in the case in the court, and they have no choice but to put them on the docket. So we're going to start entering things and that are going to be where the public can see them, and that's going to be a very big, big step here now. And so that's why we need affidavits from anybody that hears anything or sees anything, and we have some pretty good ones coming in the Bundy case and out west that we're going to need to file very shortly. I don't know if everybody's seen the analysis, the video analysis on the shooting that was done by a particularly expert man that worked in the field, and I'm not going to give his name because I don't know that he wants his name given, but it doesn't matter. It's out there. It's online. It's on YouTube. Go watch it. There's two. There's one about the roadblock, how it was set up, how it was premeditated murder, how it was designed to make it so that they couldn't stop, that they would have to crash through, so that they had an excuse to shoot them and kill them, and how they actually worked that out and facilitated it. It's really disgusting because you get sick to the stomach when you realize that every single step of the way was premeditated and calculated. Right to the first stop, and then they shot at the truck to get them to run, knowing that there was a roadblock a mile down the road. Why would you stop somebody a mile before your roadblock and then shoot at them when they open the window up? That's to make you run so that you can't stop, so that they can, as you come in, and as he came in, there were shots fired. And every time a shot was fired, his foot came off the brake because he was flinching and pulling up. It's a natural reaction. And by the video and the software that the guy used, you can actually see the truck speed up for each time the shot was fired. And they did that purposely to it was premeditated and precalculated in order to provoke them into firing, to have them fear for their lives, and to have them crash into that barrier. And then they were firing at the truck so that their only chance of survival, or so they thought, would be for them to fire back at them, which they didn't do. They had guns in there and they didn't do it. And then the second video talks about the foam bullet that they shot LaVoy with underneath his left arm, I think it was, or whatever was the opposite arm that he carried the gun in, so that he would reach down and make it look like he was going to draw a gun. And he reached and he did it three times and never pulled the gun out. So these are things you got to watch. It's unbelievable, the professionalism and the technology that was used. And there's more. That's just what's online. There's more to that analysis than what's online. And I'm not going to even reveal it, because if necessary, it'll come out in the case. There's more damning evidence that the FBI lied and played around and did all kinds of illegal stuff in order to cover up that murder. And the judge will not let them bring up that the name of LaVoy or the shooting or anything. And meanwhile, here's Ryan Bundy with a bullet in his arm that they want to take out because it holds the identity of a murderer, basically. Because there was no reason for them to be shooting into that truck even after it stopped, and indiscriminately through the roof where they could hit anybody. They didn't even know who to provoke them. So this is what's going on. I don't know if you know it. You know it now. You know, I'm going to go ahead and. And hey, Jan, is there any other things that announcements before I turn it over to Brent? I assume Brent is here this week. I don't know. I've been kind of busy. Are you there, Jan? Maybe not. Maybe I'll just go ahead and turn it over.
I have a couple, but I'll add them here after Brent talks, okay?
Okay, so we got some things coming up. And actually, there was one or two I wanted to mention, but we'll go ahead and let Brent do his thing, and then we'll do the little question and answer afterwards. Okay, Brent, you're on. Take it away.
It says I'm unmuted, so I'll get going. Thanks, Gerard. I'll get right with it here. We're talking about the militia clauses. We've been at it quite a while. I hope we're picking up some ideas. I like to say when I begin that the only remedy for lawlessness is law. There is no other remedy. Never has been, never will be. If people are doing wrong, and no man, by the way, has a right to do wrong, And if people are doing wrong, the only remedy is that they do right. The militia of the several states, that phrase taken from our United States Constitution, there are four militia clauses, and the four militia clauses refer to four classes of men. One class of men is the class we call presidents of the United States. It delegates duties to the president of the United States, our Constitution does, and one of those militia clauses. Secondly, congressmen of the United States, senators and congressmen in the House of Representatives, our Constitution delegates duties, certain duties to them respecting the several, that means the separate militias of the 50 states. And the third militia clause delegates duties to state government, namely governors and state legislators, and they have a specific duties that are distinct from presidents and congressmen of the United States. So three clauses, three classes of men. And then there's one clause that's different from all the others because it doesn't delegate anything. It just recognizes a duty and says it will protect it. And that we call, that clause we call the Second Amendment. It recognizes a duty. What is a duty? It is a fundamental right, not any right. A fundamental right. What is a fundamental right? A fundamental right is one of those rights that God bestows to the individual directly. Directly, not indirectly. He does not, those rights he does not delegate to anyone else, any institution, any government, any church body, any pope, any leader of religion or government or a combination thereof. Any institution, such as a school, and then over to the individual. No, these are the rights, and rights are duties that are delegated directly to the individual. I was reading the other day in Blackstone. I've been reading Blackstone for years, and I'm still reading Blackstone. The fourth volume, I'm going through them again. I'm in the fourth volume, about three-quarters of the way through. And I noticed more and more as I read, he's very precise with his words. He did a great job. But he equates the word duty with the word right. He equates the two in one place. And I said, oh, well, that makes sense because that's the true etymology, the true meaning of the word right. As is often said, and not really accurately said, it's said that every right has a corresponding duty. That's not true. Every right is a duty. And that is the meaning of that old Germanic Anglo-Saxon word, Reich. We might spell it a little different than the Germans, and even today there are two words in the German tongue. One is the word Reich, spelled without a G, of course. And the other word for law, in the German tongue, has to do with maybe what is mine and what I can be selfish about. But the things they called rights and our common law anciently among the Anglo-Saxons and the Anglo-Danes was called the Volkreich. And that didn't mean the people's selfish wants. Volk means people, the people, and Reich means duties. And Volkreich, our common law, the understanding of it among those ancient people, those tribes, when they brought it to England, their understanding was that the Volkreich was the people's duty. The people's duty to do what? Well, to govern. Because among those tribes, as among the Celts, by the way, Algernon Sidney makes this point, among all of those tribes, there were no paid government employees, just as there was not and were not any paid government employees in Israel. There weren't any. The way God gave it to them, the law by which they were governed, no government employees paid So the duties fell upon who? The people. And I've said it before, I want to say it again, to stress it. The phrase of our Constitution of the United States, the people, not a people, the people, definite article, is lifted direct from the Geneva Bible originally, not the King James, the Geneva Bible, the Bible that our first fathers brought to America. They wouldn't touch the King James for reasons of our common law. We'll talk about that some other time. But the phrase, the people, is lifted from the Old Testament of the Bible. It is a translation of the Hebrew phrase, ha'am. Ha is the definite article in Semitic speech. And am means people. But it didn't mean people in general. What ha'am means, translated in the Old Testament, the people, appears hundreds of times. It always refers to an armed band of men. Always. Now, there are a few times, it most always refers to the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel. But there are a few times it refers to the armed men of their enemies, but it does always refer to armed men. And so when our Constitution says the people, it follows the tradition of our forebears, the Puritans and the Presbyterians and the Dutch and German Reformed groups that came to America at that time. And the people to them meant the males that were able-bodied to carry, wield a weapon in battle. And of that group had two rights, duties, responsibilities. Number one, and by the way, these are governing rights. Number one was to be a juryman, to serve on the jury. The jury is ancient also, part of our both right, part of our common law, to serve on the jury. And second, armed defense. And those two duties are the foundation behind our oath that every person serving in government, state, and federal, our Constitution requires to take, to defend the law of the land. Article 6 of our Constitution says the Constitution is the law of the land, to defend our Constitution, the law of the land. They used to say law of the land. But to defend it against all enemies, foreign, that means by force of arms as a member of the militia, and domestic, that means to serve on the jury. And, if need be, bring suit yourself. That's the simplicity of the governing responsibilities of the people of the United States. When the Constitution says, we the people, I want to be utterly accurate here. Militia duty is not a duty of the female of our species. If a female, a woman, wants to carry a gun, there's no law against it, a common law, but she has no duty to be a member of the militia. Now, in our past, we've had women that wanted to be members of the militia, even during the war, our war for separation with Britain. Most famous of those women was a gal by the name of Molly Pitcher. They called her Molly Pitcher. I don't think that was her real name, but that's what the men called her. And Molly, I think she got that name because she would carry water to the men that were manning the cannon. And on a hot day, that's ugly work with that black powder and smoke all around you. But she also would help the men in the artillery. She'd hand them cannonballs. Of course, cannonballs weren't, they were heavy, but they weren't real big, and she could handle them. And the story goes, I'll diverge for a moment if you'll indulge me with a story, but the story goes that she could cuss and chew tobacco with all of them. Now, I don't find that attractive myself, and that may be laughable and all, but I wouldn't encourage any woman to do that. But they said she could, but she was reaching for a cannonball once in the heat of battle. Of course, she wore a dress. It would have been wholly unacceptable in those days that a woman wear anything but a dress, no matter what she was doing, even if she was chewing tobacco. But she had a dress on, and she stretched one leg out to reach to grab a cannonball, and her legs were spread apart, and the British cannonball went between her legs, tore her dress and petticoat off. Of course, it was moving pretty fast. The dress and petticoat didn't have time to get out of the way, so it just grabbed them, tore them off, and buried the dress and petticoat in a mud bank behind them, and all that was sticking out was a bit of the dress and petticoat. And she laughed. The men that were with her said this. She laughed and said, you know what? If that had been a little higher, it might have taken off something else. Well, that's Molly Pitcher. Now, I don't see that that's an example that I would want my daughters to follow. As a matter of fact, I've told them, if the draft comes up and they say you have to register, there's going to be some serious trouble. And the reason I say that, now that I'm on the subject, I'll go ahead and finish it. The Bible tells us that the female of our species has some very important duties to our country, but serving as a member of the militia is not one of them. But without question, nature teaches us, and it's been observed, that the female of our species is more deadly than the male. But that does not mean, again, that she's to serve as a militiaman. And her job is much more important. Her job is to be the guard, the home guard. The old translation says keepers at home, but that's outdated, and it does not mean to us what the Greek word there, the New Testament, once meant. What it means is home guard, because when men are away, and increasingly we should be sensitive to this from what we see around us, the swirling darkness and danger that now surrounds our homes and the sanctity of the home is being threatened. I told my own children, they're grown last night, I told a couple of them that aren't yet married. I said, when you get married, Lord willing, and have children, you're going to be responsible for everything that comes across the door, threshold of your house and comes into your house. And you're going to answer to God for everything that is pumped into your house through the electronic media. Because whatever is pumped in that doesn't please the only true lawgiver will defile the inside of the sanctity of your home. And don't think it won't have an effect. It will. And you're responsible. And you'll answer for it. And you'll suffer for it if you don't do it. And that's exactly what happened, of course. The home guard, that's what the female of our species is to do, and that can be a tough job. My own wife for now of almost 40 years, called me in the middle of the night. She was in our home. I was back east, back in the Wabash Valley. That's where I'm from, but she was in her home out west. And I was staying at my mother and father's house. I'm fortunate. They're still alive. They're not young, but they're still alive. I love to be with them. I was staying there, and I was arguing a case back there in the Seventh Circuit. I got a call. It was about midnight, a little after where I was, a little after 10 o'clock out west. And she said, I'm scared. I don't know what to do. And I was on the phone. I said, well, what is it? She said, somebody's outside banging and screaming. Several men, and they're shining their flashlights in our windows, and they're banging on the windows and screaming at us to open the door. And I said, well, who is it? She said, I don't know. I said, well, holler, I'll keep the phone on, holler through the door and ask them who it is. So she screamed out. I was listening on the phone. She said, who is it? And they said, it's the sheriff's department. Open up. And she said, what should I do? I said, well, don't open up. Ask them what they want. She said, they said, we got papers to serve. And I said, okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to tell them they can't come in before you unlock the door. And then unlock the door and just crack it a little. And tell them they can, before you open it, tell them they can slip the paper through the crack and then shut the door and lock it. And she did. And they slipped her the papers. And then we waited a little bit, and I could hear the racket starting again. They were screaming and hollering like a castle of banshees. And I said, something stinks here bad. Of course, I thought that at the beginning, but it was starting to stink worse. And they said, I said, holler outside. She said, what should I do? Holler outside and ask them what they want. Again. And she said, what is it you want? And they said, we want Brent. Well, Brent was 2,000 miles away or more. I said, tell them Brent's not here. Brent's not here. So she hollered out and said, Brent's not here. And they said, well, we've got another paper to serve you. And I thought to myself, now what is the game? What are they trying to do? I said, well, tell them they can slip the paper through just like they did before. But they can't come in. Don't unlock the door until you tell them all that. So told the deputy that was doing the talking. And he said, okay. And she unlocked the door and cracked it. And when she did, the sergeant, he was a sergeant among the deputies, stuck his foot in the door, slammed it open, knocked her out of the way, and they swarmed in, over a half a dozen. I forget how many they were. And they ran everywhere inside of her house looking for me. And I tell you this story to enlighten you about the law of the Fourth Amendment for just a minute and to maybe give you some pointers about what you should do when people want in, like police. It could be anybody else. I had a fellow tell me the other day, he had a man who didn't have a cop car or a uniform on kick his door in, and he was off duty. Bad situation. This is happening more and more, of course, you know that. Well, what that deputy did in the case of busting in our house, looking for me, looked under the bed, looked in the closets, couldn't find me. The reason they did what they did, watch me close on this, they wouldn't have come inside, and I learned a lesson too. They wouldn't have come inside if Susan had not said, Brent's not here. But when she said, Brent's not here, they thought, they knew that Brent had to be there. They'd calculated it, extrapolated it from all the information they had, and they knew Brent had to be there. When she said he's not there, they said to themselves, we've got her. She's just committed a felony. All we got to do if we bust in is find Brent, and then we can arrest her for the felony of lying to a police officer. And we've got them all. They busted in and didn't find me. And then they didn't know what to do because they busted in, of course, without warrant. Now, warrant isn't just a piece of paper. Warrant is an old word that means authority. And they don't, the cops, the law enforcement, they don't always have to have a piece of paper written out from a judge to have what we call authority to come in a fellow's house. Now, this fellow that told me the other day that the cops, off-duty cop kicked in his door. He didn't have authority to do what he did. But he said, he's now saying he had authority. But he didn't. It was a mistaken situation. But he didn't have probable cause. If a cop is in hot pursuit, he's chasing somebody, somebody runs in a house, he has authority. That means responsibility to bust in and do what he thinks best. Break down doors. He doesn't have authority just to hurt people, but he does have authority, as the law says, to break doors down or windows or break in and arrest a fleeing person of whom he has probable cause he's committed a felony. Well, they didn't have that. But see, they thought they had probable cause in this way. They thought that my wife had committed a felony. That gave them probable cause to come in. Now, you say, well, they still need a piece of paper from a neutral detached magistrate, and they weren't in hot pursuit of anybody. You're right. I say, of course, still, they didn't have authority, but the way the law now is, and the way the courts have done it, the Fourth Amendment law comes down to this. It doesn't come down to a piece of paper anymore like it did not too many years ago. You had to have a warrant on a piece of paper from a neutral and detached magistrate. But what the courts are saying now is, to sum it up, if they bust into your house without that piece of paper from a neutral detached magistrate, they bust in and they find evidence of a crime, then the courts aren't going to exclude evidence on the basis of the fruit of the poisonous tree. They're going to say they had good warrant. Well, let's say they bust in looking for one thing and they find something else under what we call the plain view doctrine. Well, that's good enough. They busted in looking for me. What if they'd have found, they could have found anything they could have said was something that was against the law. If they'd have found it in plain view and they didn't go looking for it, then the courts no doubt would have said, well, that's okay. You can bust in and do that kind of thing, as long as you find evidence of a crime. So when you deal with police officers and they want to come in your house, your first step is don't let them in. Just say and tell them, no, you can't come in. No, you can't come in. Unless you've got a warrant. If they have a warrant, that's different from a neutral detached magistrate. That's a different story. But if they say we're going to bust down your door, you're down to options at that point. One of the options you may take is, and I've advised people to do this before, but it could get you hurt. But it might be the best option and not get you hurt too, because if you don't open the door in some cases, they're going to bust it down anyway, and then people may get hurt anyway. But one option is this, and I throw this out for your consideration. Do like I told Susan. Tell them, you can't come in. I'm going to open the door. If you have a piece of paper, give it to me. And then if they bust in or open the door, then the burden's on them to prove that they had probable cause to come in. But the other option with that, kind of like that, is just to say, you can't come in. You can't come in, but the door is unlocked. But if you break it open, I'm going to take you to court. But unlock the door so they don't break it down. And then get on the telephone and call the sheriff. That's what I'd do. Always call the sheriff. Call the sheriff's office, make a report of an illegal entry as soon as you can. I've even known people that have done that before they broke in. In the preface of my booklet, called Militia of the Several States, I have there an instance of, that's how I opened the book, an instance of something that happened back when I was a teenager, when I was 19, in my home county, where a motorcycle, a rough motorcycle bunch, call them a gang, I suppose, came through a little settlement in the Wabash Valley and kicked in the door of a diner because they were drunk and hungry, and the local militia, that's what they were, whether they understood it or not, came with their shotguns and rifles and surrounded them. And some violence was done, destroyed a motorcycle, but didn't really hurt anybody, and more than hurting their pride, I don't suppose, but those people never came back. The sheriff showed up in that situation and took control of the men that were armed, and it all worked out very well, just, by the way, just the way it's supposed to work out. Something I'll never forget. At any rate, we're talking about the militia of the several states. Let me check my time. I'm usually more disciplined than to get that distracted, so I won't talk long, though. I'll finish up here. Small arms fire from American civilians, said one Japanese flyer after attacking Pearl Harbor, was so thick you could walk on it. Small arms fire from American civilians on the island of Oahu, said one Japanese flyer after attacking Pearl Harbor, was so thick you could walk on it. I would never invade the United States, said Japanese Admiral Yamamoto, during World War II. I would never invade the United States because there would be a gun behind every blade of grass. Well, he knew that America was one of the few nations in the world that were heavily armed. Not militarily, just the militia, folk, were heavily armed. And is that true yet today? I think it largely is. I think that of all those four groups, the four militia clauses I referenced a while ago, presidents, United States congressmen and senators, state governors and legislators, those three groups of people have utterly rejected and refused their duty under our Constitution respecting the militia clauses. There are certain things they're supposed to do, and they haven't even begun to try to do them. However, the responsibilities of the militia of the several states, according to our Second Amendment. Those folks have done their responsibility. They're armed, largely armed in our United States, not all of us, but most of the militia of the several states are armed, many of them, and probably America is more highly armed than any country in the world, and anyone who would consider invading would have to consider that it would be an impossible situation to occupy territory here, as long as Americans are armed. And that's why we have the right to keep and bear arms. The militia of the several states discourages invasion and enables freedom at the same time. And our Second Amendment makes that point. It says freedom is possible only if the militia of the several states are free. Their right, their duty to carry a loaded weapon and keep it in their house at all times. As long as that duty is being fulfilled, we will have freedom. The security of the free state, our Second Amendment says. A militia, well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state. That's a statement of fact, not proven, just forthrightly stated, because it is something we ought to just take judicial notice of. It's just a flat fact. It is self-evident. Well, that being true, says the folk that drafted the Second Amendment, that being true, that a security of a free freedom of a state, its security, is possible only with the militia, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. There, see, there's that phrase, the people, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. When war began, most Japanese people knew little of Americans. We were as foreign to them as they were to us. I remember when people used to say, what is Vietnam? Where is it? I never heard of the place. Well, it wasn't but a few years everybody in America knew where Vietnam was. Well, that's the way Japan was. People didn't know much about Japanese people. They knew there was a place over there called Japan. To say it the way my parents and grandparents say it, that's the way they used to say it. Didn't know much about it. It was foreign to them, and we were foreign to them. I saw a picture not long ago of Japanese, painted by a Japanese artist during World War II, and he painted a picture of many American soldiers in battle array, in their battle stances with their rifles and their bayonets, some of them down on the ground firing, some squatting, some had their weapons propped on tree limbs, and every one of them, friends, neighbors, and relatives, every one of the Americans they painted looked exactly alike. And it used to be said of them, Americans used to say of them, they all look alike. Well, they didn't look alike to each other, but we looked alike to them. We were foreign to them. But what did surprise the Japanese, having not known much of us, was the armed aggression of military and non-military Americans on the island of Oahu. That surprised them when they tried to attack. And that's what led them eventually to forego any ideas of invading, although they did try to invade, of course, in the Aleutian Islands and did occupy for a short time at the far reaches of those islands. But it struck fear into them, and they didn't realize what they were up against. It's easy to fight when everything's right, as the writer says, and wallow in fields of glory, and it's easy to cheer when victory is near. But when things aren't right, it's not so easy to fight. And the Japanese discovered that things weren't exactly right after a certain period of time. Those who drafted and signed our Constitution were savvy, and they were sharpened to dangers at home, whether from their own government or from insurrection. In fact, as each man picked up the quill to scribe his name to our Constitution and then to scribe his name later to our Bill of Rights, the reek of gunpowder lingered in their noses because they'd lived through the crucible of war on their own soil. War by invasion of their fellow Brits, with whom they bared much common blood, and by even their own neighbors termed Tory, if you've never read about the dangers that patriots in America faced from Tories, it's hard to imagine what that kind of war is. I remember reading about J.P. Martin, 7 years Continental Army from Connecticut. He ran into a fellow while on patrol, and the man started chasing him. He was a British soldier. He chased him and chased him and chased him. He was running through the woods, jumping across creeks and fences and walls. This fellow was hot after him, and he came to a place where a farmer had felled some trees the year before, or that year, to let them lay. And we used to do this, let the trees lay a few years before you cut them up for firewood so they'd be dry. Well, the tree was there, and we couldn't get around it fast enough, and he thought he'd get through the edge of it, and tried to get through the edge of it. He fell down, he got his foot caught between two limbs, one cranked over the top of the other one, and his foot was stuck, and he couldn't pull it out. He didn't have time to jump up and untangle himself, and here come up this fellow behind him, and he had his saber drawn. And he looked up at him, and it was a kid he'd went to school with in the little local school, a friend of his. They grew up together, and they were very close. And he was laying on his belly down, and this friend of his took his saber and gave him a full-force whack across the back of his thighs and split him open. Laid him up for several months, cut tendons. But his point in telling the story was, it's those people that are closest to you that can be most dangerous. I told my children that last night even. I said, the evil empire will manipulate their minions to find out the people close to you that have a weakness, and they'll use that to get at you. That's the way it is in this old world. We must be always on our guard. But these men that signed the Constitution, they'd learned that. They learned that it was those close to them that could be dangerous. And they'd learned that such aggressors only fear a militia. They don't fear an army. Listen, our armies of the United States and our armed forces of the United States, I'll close with this, are worthless if the wrong person gets control of the wrong person. If the wrong person gets control of a general officer of our army, they've got control of the whole army. And those kind of things can be done and have been done and are often done and are being done now. There are many, many, many people in the employ of our federal and even our state governments now that are entirely controlled by foreign powers. The great contributor to the Clinton Foundation, the contributors, are those that live a lifestyle of warfare against our lawgiver and what we have traditionally believed is right, just as the Japanese did, but now it's the Islamic people. The Pope of Rome, of course, is in support, he's in support of Islam, and other people in power and government are in support. I've heard generals of our army, general officers now say, well, I'm not going to make this decision or that decision, that would bring war with Russia. Well, if they're not going to make the decision, who will? Well, what they mean to say is, people above them, well, who's above general officers? Well, there may be a few other general officers, but ultimately it's the whoever wields the power in the White House or whoever controls the person sitting in the White House, he becomes a lackey or she becomes a lackey for powerful, evil, perverted men. What good's an army or a navy or the Air Force, the Marines? And they wouldn't even know, you see. They're trained to obey orders. They wouldn't know a foreigner was controlling the people that are giving them orders? No, and they won't be told, and they won't tell them for that reason. But militia of the several states, that's a whole different story. Because our Constitution says that the officers of the militia of the several states must be appointed locally within the states. The presidents and the congressmen don't have power to do that. The armed forces, the general officers don't have power to do that. That's all by design, because we know that just controlling one person or a few persons, you can hijack the entire armed forces of the United States. Well, this is Brent Alan Winters. I am my radio shows this way. This is Brent Alan Winters coming to you from the heart of the Wabash Valley. And I'm done, Gerard. You can take it back. If anybody has questions, I'm willing to answer them or respond to them, I should say.
Okay, that was good, Brent. Thank you very much. I just opened the queue. I'll give people a few minutes to get in here if they got any questions for Brent. Yeah, a lot of good points there. And, you know, we have a lot of hunters. I'm going to give a sneak preview here. And I just wanted to make a comment that these hunters that have these high-powered rifles that use them, they're fulfilling a couple clauses of the militia, of the Constitution, of the militia clauses of the Constitution. They don't even realize that they're already doing it, right? So
that's my point of view, yeah.
Right.
And
so
it is a good thing that men have had this in their head all this time, but we can always learn more about the militia clauses. Go together, and they are like part of it. They're like a fabric that pulls the Constitution of the United States together, an important part, an indispensable part. And Justice Story served longer than any justice on our Supreme Court, said that his great fear, he said this 175 years ago, his great fear was that we would simply ignore these clauses. That it wasn't that he feared we would reject them. His fear was that we would just over time, more and more ignore them, and that's what's happened. So we need to be talking about them.
Yes, I agree, and I think you know, a lot of these gun clubs and gun organizations like Scope, very good organizations, but I think they'd be very easy to be educated in the Constitution once they realize these simple things. You know, they've tried to vilify that M word. And meanwhile, it's our heritage, and they're doing it, and they should understand what their duty is. If we can educate them to their duty, we wouldn't have any trouble starting committees of safety and things like that, because that falls hand in hand with the enemies, foreign and domestic. If you know the Constitution and you know what your duties are, it'll be very hard for a usurper to stand in our counties. If we have our counties back. But I don't want to go on too much. I'll end now because we got a couple of people in the queue, Brent.
Okay.
Okay, I got Laura, it looks like. You've been unmuted.
Hi, George. Laura. Hey.
Hey.
Brent. I just want to know if you I had a question for a friend. You know, if you don't believe in marriage through the state, and you are married through the state because you figured it out later on and you want to get a divorce, how do you get a common law divorce?
Well, excuse me just a minute. Had to clear my throat. Been talking too much. It's not the... You don't get a divorce. How do I put this? I just did a wedding not long ago. And married a couple, and I made the comment that the ceremony didn't marry anybody. The piece of paper that they may have that I may sign, that if they want to file one, that didn't marry anybody. Your marriage license doesn't marry you. God, the lawgiver himself, says that he puts men and women together in marriage. And when we have these ceremonies, all we're doing is acknowledging what we believe God has done. And so it's not possible, if God has done it by his authority, it's not possible that anyone but him could pull it apart. And that's what the law of God teaches throughout the Bible. The words of Jesus Christ himself are to that effect. To say, well, I want to unmarry or get divorced because the state's involved, no. Let's say that you got a marriage license, and you come to a realization later, I didn't need to get a marriage license. What did I get a marriage license for? All that did was tell the state that I had to have their permission to get married. Well,
and they own
ask,
my kids,
but,
and they own
well,
my children.
But they don't. Let's just ask a rhetorical question. as a matter of law, and in God's eyes, is it possible that I can be enslaved by any other man? Well, Tom Jefferson tells us, Declaration of Independence even makes it kind of clear, that that's not even possible. It is not possible that anyone could take my fundamental rights from me. It's not even possible, says James Madison, or John Adams made it even clearer, it's not possible that I could give them away. You can't do that. Because they're so inextricably bound up in your being, God did it. And he who has the power to give and do is the only one at common law that has the power to take away. And our common law is just a recognition of the law of God. And it's part of our law of agency. It's part of our law. It's an overarching principle of our law that only he who has the power to give something, whatever it is, he is the one who has the power to take it away. Now listen, if somebody goes and buys a marriage license, does that mean that they got permission from the state to get married? And I say no, because no man has a right to do wrong. They didn't have the right to issue a license. God did that. I don't need permission from you to get married. They didn't have a right to do that. It's a farce. It's a ruse. It has no legal force in the eyes of God. So we don't have to worry about undoing those kind of things. Listen, if you sell your soul to the devil, and people do that all the time without even knowing it. I think some people do it consciously. You sell your soul to him? Does that mean that he owns your soul? And the answer is no, it doesn't. Because he didn't give your soul to you. God did. And he didn't have the right to buy it. You don't have the right to give it away. If some man comes and enslaves you, does that mean that he's taken your freedom away? No, it doesn't. It means that for whatever reason, you've been subjected physically. That's what that means. And we're in that position in America. I understand that in a lot of ways. And increasingly, the evil empire is on top of us, trying to bar us from doing what God has given us to do. And what is our duty to do? It's our duty to defend our jurisdiction, because you can't get rid of it. Your right to marry who you want, the Supreme Court of the United States, as an example, and the other courts in our country, state and federal, and it's gone to the Supreme Court, have recognized that the right to marry another person is a fundamental right given direct by God to the individual, and it's not included in our Bill of Rights. Well, of course, our Bill of Rights says that this Bill of Rights doesn't include everything, and there are other rights, other fundamental rights that God has given men. Our Supreme Court has recognized that marriage is one of those. Well, that being true, anything that you do to compromise your ability to fulfill your duty, that is your rights before God, you go out and buy concealed carry and licenses like in Chicago, you got to have a license, all that baloney, all that extra constitutional stuff. Let's say a church goes out and, well, I got to incorporate, we got to get an incorporation so that we can have tax deductions. Well, that's not true. You don't have to have a corporation under a law to have a tax and deduction as a church. All of those things that the evil empire talks you into doing is just luring you in so they can put a ring in your nose. And then they get that ring in your nose, and then they say, I got you. You're stupid, aren't you? And then you feel cowed. And you go, what do I do? No pun intended. No, what do I do? They've done this to me. I don't know how to get out of it. No, what you do is you say, just like the people in the colony said, they said, you no longer have right here. Just get out. Get out. You're killing us. You're maiming us. And now you've got plans to infect the slave population in America with smallpox, with a plan of killing all of us. You've You've drawn down the French Jesuits with the Indian tribes of the North to massacre women and children in our colonies. You're now sending your military, American or British and Hessian soldiers here, to burn our towns, and they did, by the way, and murder our inhabitants. They did all those things. Did that mean they had a right to do it? No, they didn't mean that. So when you talk about marriage, don't even talk that way. Don't ever talk like somebody would hear you and say, well, you're admitting that the government owns your children. That's not true. It can't be true. It's legally impossible, no matter what you've done, that the government owns your children. Now, it is possible that the government can take your children and abuse them if you, for whatever reason, that you let it happen or they overpower you, and that happens too. I know that. Probably people listening to this conversation have called me and talked to me about that. That's happened to them. I've had them threaten it with me. I just told you the story about what happened there, and it got worse. I didn't tell you the whole story. It got worse from there. All of those things happen. But let's start, friends, neighbors, and kin, let's start with words. Let's start talking right so we think right, so we act right. Do not ever use words that would lead anyone to believe that you think the government is in a contract with you in your marriage. First of all, marriage is not a contract between a man and a woman. Now, that's abundantly clear, not only from the law of God, but from man's law in most of the states. A marriage is a promise to God, not a promise to your spouse. You can promise your spouse the same thing you promised to God, but understand first and foremost, that's why we don't call them marriage oaths. We call them marriage vows. A vow is a promise made direct to God. And I said that when I did this wedding a month or so ago. I said, understand something. We're not here to make promises to each other, and you're not making promises to each other. Yeah, you do say, oh, you know, I thee wed and all that, but that's part of the traditional ceremony, and we did that. And there's nothing wrong with making promises to your spouse, but understand something. If you're just making promises to your spouse and you're not making one to the creator of heaven and earth, then when your spouse, if it's nothing but a mere contract, when your spouse breaches, then you've got the right to breach too. Well, that's not what God says marriage is. Your promises are to God, so when your spouse breaches his or her promise to God, you don't have the option of running away and say, you breached, so I'm out of here. It didn't work that way. Now, if you do that, and there are circumstances, according to the law of God, where you have that option. I'm trying to cover a big subject shortly here, and I understand that, and I know what those options are. But God doesn't demand them. But at the same time, there does come a point where those options are available to get out of the marriage. But that's not to be the governing, foremost, general law of marriage. The law of marriage is, I stay married not because my spouse doesn't, not because my spouse obeys his or her vows to God. I stay married because I obey my vows to God. It's analogous to the situation. I hate family law. I haven't done a lot, but the few I've done, I've told my clients, especially the men, listen, when the judge gives his order in this divorce decree, I don't care what your ex-wife, or not really your ex-wife, the gal you were married to, I don't care what she does, whether she keeps her end of it or not, what the judge tells her to do. I don't care how bad it gets. You do what the judge says, because your commitment is to the court, not to her. Well, I know all analogies break down at some point, but there's some similarity there in that when the judge in the state court tells somebody what to do, gives them a decree, we say, that ends the matter. It matters not what the other person does. Well, it's the same way with the judge of all the universe, as our Declaration of 76 puts it. When you make a promise to him, your commitment is done. And if you have made that promise, that commitment to him, that vow, he puts you together with your spouse, he'll hold you to it. Unless you have an exit clause. And there are some in the Bible, some other time, time permits, we can talk about that. But now, don't think that the government owns your children or your marriage. I don't care what you did. They don't, period. Because to say they do is to allow them to continue in what is wrong, and no person in government or out has the right, the duty, that is the duty, the option even, to do wrong. I hope that helps a little. I did a lot of talking.
Yeah, I can tell her, but I can tell her in a couple words what you said.
Right, but they tell
thank
me.
You.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they. You can listen to this again. I hope I didn't cross myself.
Oh, thank you.
Cross my wire. You're welcome. My pleasure.
All right.
Right. Okay. California Fred, we'll do a couple more, and then we'll cut to this.
Hello, this question is for Brent Winters, please.
Yeah,
it's
there.
It's actually four questions regarding the militia, sir. And I'll make them real quick and you can answer at your leisure. Number one, the state appoints the officers. Where does the sheriff fit in his county as an officer in the militia? Because he obviously would be. Second question is, can you have multi-state capacity within the militia? Can you be a member of a militia in 5 or 6 states? Like, let's say you live in a motorhome. What about the gun laws? Do they apply to the state you're actually in or the license plate on your motorhome? And the last part of the question is, obviously, there's nothing in the Constitution that disenfranchises anyone. So felons are automatically members of the militia also. No, I'll wait for the answers, sir.
Well, those are good questions. I'm glad you asked them. Give me an opportunity maybe to clear up, not clear up, or maybe some enlightenment. I don't know that I'll answer all the questions that my answers may beg, but first, the sheriff. The paycheck of a sheriff comes, in most instances that I know about, from state taxpayer money. But his jurisdiction is limited to the raw territorial boundaries, in most cases, as a general rule, of his county and the people that are residents of that county. A sheriff is bound by oath to enforce the laws of the state wherein his county lies. If the state legislature does their duty under the militia clauses of our Constitution, they will pass provisions that will better guide the organizing of the militia in their state and the appointment of officers. I'm going to drop a footnote here. The last thing in my little booklet concerning the militia clauses of our Constitution, the last thing I have in there is a model state militia statute. A model state militia statute, and I'll credit myself, and I thought through a lot of it. I don't know if I got it all right, but I'll credit myself, but credit also my boys, my older boys. They had, my older boys are seafaring men, and they've spent time on cargo ships and merchant ships, and they've been to South Africa, and they took a particular interest in South Africa and its history, and did a lot of reading, not to mention visiting the place, and they filled me in on the Boers of South Africa. I asked them a lot of questions. They became kind of experts on the subject. You know, the Boers organized against the Boers, B-O-E-R-S, that's a Dutch word. Boer, it means farmer. And that's when we say people are Boers, that's from our long time past when people said that farmers were boring people. And I found the opposite to be true, but that's what they said. Well, the Boers were the Dutch farmers. They were very Christian men in South Africa. They were Dutch Calvinist Christians. And hardworking farmers, their experience there has been analogous to ours here in America. They were pioneers and settlers, and they settled the land and broke it open with the plow and did all those things. Well, the British wanted the things they found there, namely gold and diamonds. And so they sent the British army down there to conquer the place. Well, they organized what we would call, and they would call in their own tongue, the militia. And they appointed their officers by a certain procedure, and they were very effective. By the way, the Boers used a rifle that was made in Europe that was smokeless, powdered. And when they fired it, you can still buy a lot of these. They're in a lot of gun shops because there were so many of them. They were so popular for so long. The smokeless powder, very effective, the kind of warfare they were waging. The British couldn't conquer them. Many great lessons to learn from the Boers of warfare when you're invaded, how they handle it. And they gave the British the most powerful military force on the planet. They gave them absolute fits. They couldn't get them down. They were tough, always on the move. They'd grab a leg of lamb and just keep riding. Well, the Boers organized, and they had a lot of good ideas about organizing the militia. And I took a few of those ideas and put them at the end of that book, in that model state militia statute. It doesn't, the Boers of South Africa, their ideas don't govern the statute, but there are a few ideas I put in there about how to choose officers and the sheriff. The sheriff can be key in that, depending upon what the state legislature wants to do. the state legislature can include him in any way they want. But the state legislature, under our Constitution, the militia clauses of our Constitution, has that option and is put in their exclusive jurisdiction to do that. So that's just some ideas of where the sheriff of the local counties might fit. Of course, the sheriff of the local county might just take it upon himself to mobilize, as some sheriffs have done here in America, the possibilities of the county, the possibilities. Possibility is a Latin-rooted word. And in Latin, you say posse. That's a Latin word, posse. And it means the power, not the power blatant, but the power latent. That means the power potential, not showing itself yet. Just the men of the county are the posse. They don't have to be armed, and that's the way, by the way, our militia is. The militia just is. The militia isn't something that has to be organized and it becomes a militia. No, the militia are. And this will bring in part of your question, too. The militia are all the men, the males, able-bodied to bear a weapon. Does that include the man that has been committed a felon by a jury? And the answer is yes, it does. It depends, of course, upon the state legislature. You see, until recently, state legislatures and feds didn't take away any gun rights from felons. That's a new development, kind of like marriage licenses. It's a new development. And felons traditionally have been able to do that, but that's up to state legislatures. By the way, all gun rights aren't taken away from felons. And that's a whole subject unto itself. It depends upon the state you're in and how the laws apply and what they apply to. But felons have a duty to do whatever they can. Remember, the militia is not just all about carrying a weapon. The beauty of the militia, and there are other people recently have pointed this out, and it's utterly true. The beauty of the militia is, the militia of the several states, that it pulls in men from every walk of life. Been able to do all sorts of things, having all sorts of extraordinary skills, everything from the skills of building to the skills of engineering. I could go on and on. Your imagination will pull all this in. As you know, men have all sorts of skills, and they would bring them to bear, and carrying a weapon is an important part of being a militia, but it's not the only part. And a militia doesn't operate unless men have the ability, and this was true. You can see it. It's mentioned in Magna Carta, 1215, the militia. They were trying to return the old Anglo-Dane common law with Magna Carta. I mean, even the Normans understood that the Norman invasion brought the imprint of Rome and softened our common law quite a bit. So Magna Carta was an attempt to revert back to the laws of Alfred the Great and Edward the Confessor. And in that document, it talks about the duties of the militiamen of each shire, that means a sheared off piece of land unto itself, shire. Today we call them counties. Each county and the townships in those days called the hundreds. The hundreds, H-U-N-D-R-E-D, it means 100. Traditionally, it was an approximation of the area of land that would encompass 100 fighting men, men able to bear arms. You see, even the organization of the counties has to do with the militia. That's our common law. And the townships, the hundreds, became the townships. And for that reason, of course, sheriffs of counties figure into this strongly, but it would be up to the state legislatures how to figure them in. So we've covered the sheriff. We talked a little bit about felons at common law, and I'm talking about the contemplation of those that ratified our Constitution, because that must inform our Constitution. And you say nobody's disenfranchised by our Constitution. No, nobody's disenfranchised. But there are some people that have some duties and other people that have other duties. And as I said before, nobody in their wildest minds, the framers of our Constitution, understanding their law at that time, would have thought that they were including, by the words of the people, including the female of our species, to take up arms. Only a nation of cowards would require the most precious commodity of a nation, the most precious and productive commodity, potentially, the female of our species. Only a coward would say, yes, they must bear arms in battle and force them to do it. And we've become a nation of cowards. It's damnable. It's dishonorable. It's despicable that we allow that kind of talk to go on and don't say anything about it. Girls, daughters, facing shrapnel and bullets getting their legs blown off. I'm no part of it. I hope you've got enough sensibility.
I understand.
Yeah.
That's
well,
what gets my goat about politically correct. I'm out.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm looking here. I think I covered everything you mentioned, didn't I? I think I did. Oh, one other thing I want to mention briefly. You mentioned
motorhomes.
Motorhomes, yeah, one other thing. At common law, traditionally, if you were within the country, or the state, we would say, the sovereigns in our country is the states. If you were within a state for 30 days or more, you had a duty to enter your name on the roll of the local militia, however the state government divided it up. Whether by counties, I think counties, of course, in common law, counties and townships are the way the militia was supposed to be organized. So if you're in a resident, 30 days or more, you were required to put your name on the rolls. But if you're not a resident, you're a vagabond, then you move on. But if you're a resident for 30 days or more, let's say you're a resident for 60 days, 90 days, you have a duty to put your name on the roll of the local militia. And then, if you move on, fine, you move on. Then you have a duty if you stay at another place that many days. I'm giving you the old time of law. What else do we have to look to for guidance? I know some states now, I'll add this quickly, that their statutes say that if they face any question in their courts that a legislation of their state legislature does not address, and I'm citing one particular state I know of, that state says if that happens and the law, the legislature hadn't addressed that problem, then the courts are required to look at the common law as it stood in the fourth year of James the First. The fourth year, James the First. That's the law, and I know of one state that's law, and I think there's two or three others. The reason I say that is this, because there are many things, fact patterns that arise and problems arise that the legislature never thought of. That's the problem, of course, with legislation. That's why a common law jurisdiction is so important, because in a common law jurisdiction, you don't look for permission to act. If the law doesn't address it, you can just do it pretty much within the laws of God. But the fourth year of James the First is the year 1607. James the First is the James of the King James Bible, James the First. But he became king, crowned in 1603. The fourth year of James the first English colony settled in America at Jamestown. And with that colony, with them, they brought with them a code called the Laws of Dugdale, which they quickly abandoned, and they went to their common law. So with that colony, the common law was established officially on this continent, and the state of which I speak at that time was part of Virginia. And so that state, their legislature says, the common law is stood in the fourth year of James the First. So that's why I hark back to our common law in these matters, because the legislatures have not said a word for 175 years that really directly addresses the common law and the responsibilities of the militia. And we have every right to do that, every right. Matter of fact, rights and duty, we have every duty to do it. And, well, that addresses mobile homes, nomads, vagabonds, and then the sheriff's duties respecting this have to do with the state legislature, whatever they say, but he would have to be included somehow, of course. And then felons. Yes, felons are members of the militia, even though they maybe don't carry a gun for whatever reason. But then again, the state legislature may say, the state's the sovereigns, they may say, you can do it. Well, I've talked enough about that. I hope I hit the nail on the head for you.
Thank you, Brent.
You have, sir. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for asking. My pleasure.
I remember watching the old Westerns growing up, and whenever they let the prisoners out of jail, the first thing the sheriff did was put their guns on the counters so they could pick them back up.
That's good. Oh, lest we forget. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. So, look at it. It must have been tradition. They wouldn't have been putting it on the boob tube otherwise, right? Anyway, I'm going to go to the next question, and it's kind of getting, maybe we should let other people come in, but go ahead. If it looks like we got Harley. He may have a question just for you, Brent. Go ahead, Harley.
Well, hello there, Brent and Gerard.
Hello.
Can you hear me well?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're blowing our doors off, as a matter of fact, but go ahead.
Yeah. All right. I'll speak normally then. Well, I go into court tomorrow to be part of jury draw, and without dragging everybody down the rabbit hole here, they had removed me from my property with false instruments and allowed a bank to bulldoze my property, and sort of complicated, but now I'm defending criminal trespass and trumped up resisting charge. That's very obviously not on the video. And my quick question is, do you have any advice, or anyone on the call, about good questions to ask of the jurors? My capacity as a pro se litigant and from a common law perspective.
Well, first thing you want to do, if you can strike jurors that are what some people call professionals. Lawyers boil it down different. You don't want school teachers, if you can avoid it, and no bankers. School teachers and bankers and engineers. School teachers and bankers and engineers, there are three things that, if you can, you want to get off the jury. Now, it's not because school teachers, bankers, and engineers are bad people. That's not it. It's not even because they may not believe like you. That's not it either. The reason you don't want school teachers, bankers, and engineers on the jury is because those kind of people often, I don't know why, they want to try to think like lawyers. And they want to approach the case like a lawyer would approach the case. Well, for crying out loud, wake up, boys and girls, I say to Americans. If we wanted jurymen to think like lawyers, we would just let the judge decide the case. We don't want that. The problem with lawyers is they're too used to it. The problem with judges is they're too used to it. And the problem with the people I just mentioned is they do know how to think often. They're used to thinking. They train people in algebra. They like to think. It's fun for them. And they try to think through what's going on. Listen, our common law is not about precision. It is not about precision. It's about fair play, substantial justice. Like you speak in the Westerns, I remember that one fellow in that old John Wayne movie. I don't remember, McCandles, maybe it was a name, I don't remember the name of it was, but he said that one fellow says to John Wayne at one point, great big guy, obviously not formally educated, but he got into a fight, and when he got done with the fight, he said, that fellow fought me a fair fight. That fellow fought me a fair fight. Well, that whole idea of a fair fight, may the best man win, all that kind of stuff, is part of our common law tradition. In South America, they don't say that. They don't say it in France or Germany. They don't say it in Italy. That's not part of their culture. It's not a part of the culture of the Arab nations at all. Fair fighting isn't what they admire. They admire deceit. They admire the bushwhack. There's nothing chivalrous. When we go to court, we want a fair fight, and a fair fight does not demand precision. I went into a courtroom one time, and there was an engineer on the jury. I knew who the guy was. He worked at a oil refinery not far away, and smart guy, nice guy. And it was a damages case about a piece of farm machinery, an applicator of fertilizer and herbicide at the same time, didn't work as advertised, worth $500,000. Well, when we got done, the jury was out for a long time. We got worried. Finally, they came back, gave us everything we wanted. I saw one of the jurors later down at Moonshine Store. If you want to know where Moonshine Store is, just type in Moonshine Store. You'll be surprised how many websites come up. Well, we were down at Moonshine Store, and I saw one of the jurors. I said, what took you guys so long? Said, well, with that engineer, you know, he said was on the jury, he was trying to calculate damages first by the month, then by the day, then by the week for losses to this fellow that was making a living putting on this fertilizer and stuff. Well, that's what held him up. Well, we didn't want that. We don't need it. Matter of fact, that subverts justice. We said, here's how much we want. Either give it to us or don't give it to us. That's what we said. You know, when juries start trying to be too precise, and the school teachers, I'm glad they're precise. Engineers, I'm glad they're precise. But remember, it is precision that made the Nazis what they were. And it is precision that destroyed their ability to fight. They had over-engineered their equipment to the point that one round of a little bullet could wipe out a whole panzer tank if it hit the right piece of equipment. Over-engineered. We seek substantial justice. We don't operate on the metric system. We operate by the length of our foot and the span of our hand. We've done that for decades, and we went to the moon like that, for crying out loud. Nobody else, well, I shouldn't say we went to the moon. I don't know if we did or not, but we've done a lot of great things. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. I don't trust the television. But what I'm saying is, when you go to choose jurors, look for those that are just folk. And remember that a thief can recognize a thief quicker than anybody else on the jury, and he'll want to send him to jail. And a murderer can recognize a murderer. Just keep that in mind. I'm throwing out principles. What a jury wants to do more than anything else, and every juror has the propensity, no matter who they are, it could be me or somebody else, they want to look for somebody. Somebody got hurt, and they want to lay blame somewhere. Give them a place to lay blame. Give it to them. And give them the law. I'm going to caution you about it. Well, I guess I couldn't caution you. You're not going to be on the jury. But, choosing the jury is important. Those are the ideas I have. If anybody else has any, they can add them.
I just had one other sort of follow-up onto that. I'd gotten a little advice on this, and I'm interested in how to best introduce jury nullification. Now, should I bring up a paper with the statute as an exhibit for all of them to have to see later? Should I bother bringing anything up in that in the jury selection process? I know it's the third rail. Any advice on that?
Well, if you bring it up, the other side then, if the other side doesn't hear the answer they want, they're going to move to strike. You're going to be facing that. And I don't know what state you're in. I don't know whatever. Even if I knew, I wouldn't know probably the demeanor of the court. I don't know the demeanor of the judge. But if you have a statute in that state that says jury nullification is part of your law, then somehow you'd want that in the jury instructions, if you could get it there. Because when you go to trial, you don't start from things before the trial. You go to the model jury instruction book for your state, and you get the jury instructions that are going to govern that jury. That's the first thing you do. That way you see where you want to go. If you don't have those jury instructions in front of you from the beginning, you're beating the air. Because in the end, the judge is going to take those jury instructions, and they may be tweaked and changed a little here and there, but there's a set of instructions out there somewhere in your state that you can get off the internet or out of a book that are substantially going to be the jury instructions for your case. That'll show you what you've got to get in the jury's minds during the trial. And jury nullification would be an important part of that to get in jury instructions. And if the other side brings up the idea that it's not to be there or says something about it because of the questions you asked, that you've got to object and get that on the record so you can appeal on that point. See, even if the judge doesn't let you bring it up, you've got to get a solid objection on the record. Say, I object, Your Honor, and he'll note your objection, make sure it's on the record, and a continuing objection that you object and say that the jury is entitled to the jury nullification instruction. Then if you lose, you can appeal. So there's two things to sum up that you want to make sure that you do during the trial. During the trial, be driving toward those jury instructions, whatever they are. And keep in mind, you're trying the case with the idea you're going to appeal it. That means you've got to make a good record of all objections. Just make sure you say them as you go. Don't fight with the judge. Never fight with the judge. Never argue with the judge unless he says he wants to know what you're thinking. Just sure you make sure you make the objections. That's the important thing.
Okay, I think I found them. Are they often found case by case, statute by statute? Because I think that's what I found. It has sort of blanks to fill in different criteria, and it has
yep.
a whole list of basically criteria, and that would be statute by statute?
Yep, that's the way they're presented, and they have blanks in them. They're model jury instructions. But you should have in your state a committee of lawyers that are part of the Bar Association that have authority to draft jury instructions and tweak them and change them and make suggestions. And if you go to the bar of your state, go to their website, you can find there more about jury instructions.
Well, I found some on statute by statute right in the state website.
Oh, man, that's good.
Vermont's pretty traditional, I'm getting. And, you know,
yeah.
I haven't even entered a plea, and I'm, you know, right off going to put in a motion for dismissal
uh-huh.
based on no warrant and some other things. And,
uh-huh.
You know, I mean, that's how I'm trying to proceed. But if they force me into this whole process, I got to be ready to act.
That's right. Your duty as a militiaman is to defend the laws of the land. And if they don't listen, you've still done your duty. It's your duty, because if you don't do it, you'll answer to God for not doing it. And your duty is double. Armed defense, enemies foreign, and enemies domestic. That means in the courts. Jury duty and bringing suit where it's required to defend the law of the land. The law of the land. The land law. And it's inextricably bound to the land, by the way.
Now, since they didn't use a warrant, they used a clerk to write up you know, it's a quick affidavit, basically suspecting that I'd broken this. And I lost my train of thought.
The affidavit was based on hearsay from the warrant.
It's okay.
Okay, good. You done there, Harley?
Yes, sir. You can proceed. Yield.
Yeah.
Appreciate it, Brent.
Okay, thank you very much. Michigan Don, go ahead. If you're there, you've been unmuted. Going once,
hello?
Michigan Don. Hello.
Hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Hey, thanks. Hey, I was wondering if you could go over again what you announced at the beginning of the call. I didn't quite get all that. You talked about SDRs being issued, and I just want to know what was going on with that and how it's different from when they were issued in 69, 79, and 2009. Why is this more severe? If you could talk about that.
Well, I don't pretend to know all the little nuances of that, except that they're not going to accept American dollars overseas. That's the difference. So whatever this new SDR is, it's going to replace the American dollar as the world's reserve currency, and therein is the problem, because that means all these Federal Reserve promissory notes are going to be, you know, so you won't be able to use them overseas. Well, you know, look at America. Used to be a great country. We didn't have to go overseas. We could support ourselves right here with our resources, and we still can, except for we've dismantled our factories and our mines and stuff. So, you know, if we got to become self-sufficient, we don't even have the factories to do it anymore. And that's kind of what the threat is here. You know, that, you know, if the dollar becomes so that it's not the world's reserve currency, that's going to put us in a third world status really quickly. You know, and so what was different on the SDRs they did back then? I don't know what the difference is as far as, you know, I know they want to do away with with paper money, ultimately they want to go to a digital money. So, and I mean, right now, these SDRs that they're issuing is between these corporations and these banks on the top, and these corporations doing international business. But that's going to filter down to us really quickly, because there's not, like I said, much of our business is done overseas. So, you know, how long can we go without overseas accepting our money? So that, I think that's what the issue is. You know, and that's why we don't know how much time we have, because you can't put a time on that. The biggest way to know what's going on and what's going to happen is to watch these banks that are getting ready to close their doors. That's what's going to determine it, because if you get runs on these banks and you get these cascading cross defaults, you see, the American dollar is worth whatever the American people think it is. It's worth the good faith and credit of the American government. If we start losing our capacity in the world for, you know, being the world's greatest army, the world's this, world's that, people lose their confidence in our money, we're done. And that can happen overnight. You know, it's different if you have a lot of value behind your money. Well, we have a lot of air behind our money. So the minute people don't think that it's the emperor with no clothes. The little boy's going to come out and say, he's naked. And people are going to go, holy crap, yeah, he is. And they're going to drop that money and run. So I think that's what the issue is. I don't know what games they're playing amongst each other. I know that. I know there's a lot of shenanigans going on, and I know they got a lot of debt that they want to cover using collateral, which is our resources. And we've already seen this in action. You know, we've seen what's going on. I mean, even in my own town here, we have a Chinese group coming in, going to put some kind of big theme park in, and they bought a hotel over here for tax sale that they're going to put the water treatment plant that they need for this water theme park. And there's some, you know, she owed taxes, they wouldn't let her pay them. I don't know, there was a bunch of baloney going on, because the county wants that land. And these are the types of things, you know. And so where's this money coming from? Everything over around here, it seems to me that the Chinese are buying up. Why? Because they have lots of American dollars. And you and I are willing to take them for our stuff. So that's all I can tell you. I mean, believe me, I could be off as far as, you know, what's the difference between these SDRs and those SDRs. I don't know. I don't know what the difference is, except for what I do know is that we got many, many trillions and trillions of dollars. They don't even tell you. We have derivatives piled up so high you can't even imagine. When that stuff starts falling, it's an avalanche that nobody's going to stop. And so that's the problem. We weren't like that back in 69, you know, and we had a gold and silver backing for a while, and our money had some value. You know, the American dollar in real buying power right now is worth, it was worth 4 cents. It's probably even less than that now, which that's is right. Disgusting.
Yeah.
You
okay,
know?
Could you share your source where you got that information from?
What's that, the SDRs?
No, they're stopping accepting the U.S. dollars overseas. What source did you?
Well, I subscribe to a lot of sources like Weiss and Porter Sansbury and that, and they've been writing and sending books to Congress that we can't keep printing the money, you know. And so there's a couple articles, and maybe we should throw some of them on the website. You know,
yeah,
that you know, maybe we can document that. Now, look, these are things that, you know, we all should have been screaming about. You know, our congressmen and senators have known about it. There have been guys way smarter than me that have been writing books and sending them to every congressman, every senator, every president. And these guys have been kicking the can down the road and down the road. And they've been blowing the horn, and they've been telling them, look, the charts, the graphs, you got this hockey stick. You can't print money when your gross national product is down on the bottom of the graph. And what you owe on interest on the debt is this hockey stick form. You're done. It's a wall. It's a cliff that you're falling off of. We're there. We're at the cliff. There's no denying it. And so you need to do something with your money now, because it's not – the American government's good faith and credit has lost credibility, and that's all it's worth. So this is what's happening. So I can I'll pull up some more documentation on what they're doing with the SDRs and see if we can't, you know, address that a little bit more. But make no mistake about it. We've hit the graph. We've hit the cliff. You know, you can't look at it's a fact that you can't borrow your way into prosperity. It can happen. You know,
right,
and that's what they've been doing.
If you could post that up at the website, that'd be awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, let me see what I can come up with. I'll try to do that and put it into one of the blogs or something. Who is this is Michigan Don? So
Don Levine,
Don Levine. Maybe I can send you something to that, effect. I'll give you some of the resources I've been reading about. Okay?
Okay. That'd be good, Gerard. Thanks.
Yep. Okay.
Goodbye.
Yep. Next question is Brad.
Hey, Gerard.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. Actually, this question was for you, so I don't know if I'm...
That's fine.
With this financial thing here, we've already done the silver and the gold thing and the food and all that, but is it worthwhile to have cash on hand?
Absolutely, because look, cash is worth what it's worth until people won't accept it anymore.
Yeah. All right, so I have cash on hand. What about the money that's in the bank, though?
It's going to be gone. Anything in the bank, they're going to look at in Greece. There's nothing new under the sun. All this stuff has been done in other countries. They've done it before. In Greece, they had what they called instead of a bailout, they called it a bail-in. And they went in and they took 50%. Other words, if you had 100,000, they took 50 of it, and there was nothing you could do about it.
Right. That's what I'm afraid of. So what would you do?
I don't know, but you see, they're already making it hard to get your money out. They don't want you to have cash. But the other thing I don't want you to do is put, look at gold, silver, rice, beans, I don't know, something that's going to be worth something, what I mean?
Yeah.
Any kind of commodity or whatever, I mean, things get really bad. Even 22 shells will be worth money more than a paper dollar will,
Right.
Look, when you have gross inflation, and they've been very good at keeping inflation down, but they hate deflation even worse, because in deflation you and I can run out and grab up deals.
Right.
And they want that only to be for them, and that's what they've been doing, So, but they've been holding inflation down pretty good with their manipulations, but all they've done is kick the inevitability down the road. At some point, they're going to get some inflation that's just going to go through the roof because, once the panic comes, then forget about it. So I don't know. I would be afraid of any money in the bank. And I mean, there's certain overseas investments you could make. It's getting a little late for that though, because they're locking things down further and further. Every time I buy something with a debit card instead of a credit card, and I try to do it overseas, I have a lot of trouble. The bank locks the card. Blah, blah, there's all kinds of baloney. So there's already trouble doing business with companies overseas, and there's a lot of companies overseas. There's a lot of companies in America who's really are based with an overseas company that's supplying them. So.
I'm basically good on, precious metals and stuff like that, which they're manipulating now anyways. But like I said, I have a little bit of cash in the bank that's parked there that I need to do something with before that gets 86, so to speak.
Yeah, well, you got to get it out of the bank somehow. I don't know. You got to turn it into something else, because they'll vacuum clean it right up. Of course, if you got too much cash on hand, then they want to say you're suspect. What are you doing? You're a drug dealer. You're this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And today's police don't have any problem confiscating your cash if they find it.
Can't buy guns. I mean, I got enough guns.
Yeah, well, I don't know what to tell you about that, but anything. There's all kinds of books on the subject of what to get in the collapse. Like, there's certain things that aren't going to be around, and those things are going to be worth more money.
Right.
I mean, just think about, even the things that they used even in the wars back then. You look at the army, it would run on tobacco, right?
Yeah.
Coffee, those type of things, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are all valuable things. They're more valuable than that stupid piece of paper when its value goes out. I'd rather have a bottle of whiskey any day that I could trade.
Right.
Than a $20 bill. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's all I can tell you. You know, it's very, you got to be practical. And it's almost like common law, common sense kind of, you know?
Right.
And even gold and silver, look, gold and silver is great, but if a collapse happens, even your gold and silver won't save you, because what will happen is we have just-in-time shipping in this country. There's nothing on the shelves. And so when everything goes off the shelves, if you can't, even if you have gold and silver, you can't buy the thing if it's not available. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if people are hungry and they're not going to trade their food for your gold and silver, and then where you're going to be is you're going to be stuck where the guy that has lots of resources is going to be getting your gold and silver for stuff like bread and beans. You know what I mean? He's going to get rich. It's for the other side of this thing, you know, when we start establishing, you know, currency between us. And that's the other thing, you know, barter and local currencies. That's going to be something that we'll have to think about and actually do, you know. So, you know, use your imagination. That's all I can tell you, you know.
All right. Thanks, Gerard.
Okay? You're welcome. Next question, Washington. It looks like Rhonda. Yes, I had to put my glasses on. You're unmuted.
Hi. I was just wondering if anybody has any information about something I read on the Internet. Supposedly Pennsylvania wants to outlaw common law in the court system.
Yeah, there's some senator that's reintroducing the bill. Somebody should take a case out and charge him with subversion of the Constitution and treason or whatever. Yeah, how can you outlaw common law unless you're going to outlaw the Constitution?
Well,
and
they'd like to do that.
Of course. Well, you know what? Let me tell you something. Every time they do something stupid like that, you know, it begs a response from us. And what happens is it's actually good for us, because it gives us an opportunity to meet them and fix things. Like, let me give you an example, kind of an outside example. Over in Portland, somebody was handing out Constitution books, and a Homeland Security officer arrested them and said, "You can't do that here." And he took them to the jail. And I only heard half the story, and I said, "My goodness, I mean, you can't stand for them arresting you for handing out Constitution books out in the street outside the jail and the court." And I said, you know, the proper response, which I ended up they did it, but my immediate thing was, the first thing I would do is go out and have a million Constitution books printed up and give them to a bunch of people and hand them out. And that's exactly what they did. And that's exactly what they did over there. And when they brought the guy to the local sheriff over there in Portland, he said, "Get out of here. We don't want you." He was smart enough to know that charge wasn't going to hold up, right? So you see,
yeah, right.
And so every time they do something stupid like that, it gives us an opportunity to win another battle where ultimately we'll win the war. Look, at fundamental principles are easy to defend because they're fundamental. They're not complicated. They should be in your chest, you know what I mean, in your heart. And so it should be very easy to defend. They've been ruled upon so many times in jurisprudence, you know, in Supreme Court rulings, and even in their own statutes you can find where these things have been spelled out. So anytime they do something really stupid, like this guy that says he wants to outlaw common law, I think this is great. I think we should pull a suit in on him for even suggesting it. You know, it begs
a response. So one of us that's in that state near where he is should at least go talk to the man.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a federal suit, and John and I and a couple of the state leaders, we discussed that very thing today. So that's definitely something that's in the works. We're not going to ignore that. And like I said, the thing with the Constitution books and you know, they're so arrogant and so ridiculous that they're starting, the snake is starting to eat the tail. Whenever they do something stupid like that, and it's up to we the people to meet that and come, you know, and that's part of the Committee of Safety thing. You know, when if you're living in a place where the government's really overbearing because it's different from place to place, and that's the whole idea behind a Committee of Safety, the local Committee of Safety take care of the local problems, and not everybody has the same problem at the same time. You know what I mean? But, I mean, things are getting more and more similar, but, you know, they have different problems out west than we have in the north here, but it's all tyranny. But you get together with the local people, something stupid like that happens where they're going to arrest somebody for handing out a book. People need to amass, you're not going to do that at a town board meeting. What you want to do is you want to have an assembly like a town board meeting, but with no town officials, and say, what are we going to do about this? Well, I think I'll print up some booklets. Let's all meet here and do this. That's what the committees of safety were all about. You know, mm-hmm. It's about people taking that civic action because the government's out of their place. They're not doing it. So it's up to who? It's up to us, because who is the government? We're the government. Who is the militia? We're the militia. It's time for us to look at they are engaging us. They are calling us out by the stupid things they're doing, I believe. And I think it begs a response. When you have a group of people like they did over in Portland with those Constitution books, no, you know, probably the word went out, don't you dare arrest any of those people, you know what I mean? Because, and there was no arrest, and they handed them out, and they set that box of books down on the vent for the jail, and with a bullhorn they yelled, and they could hear it all through the building, and they handed out Constitution books all day. Now, how do you think that federal marshal that did that, how's he probably got pulled on the carpet for being so blatantly stupid, right? But
right.
Look at they're doing what they learn only because they're minions, and you don't have to order minions. Minions kind of get the idea of what they're supposed to do, and they do it. But you know, they get overzealous, and they don't really understand the plan, and they're arrogant, and they think there's no consequences, and so therefore, so a lot of times they're handing us things. We got to be able to recognize those things and go out and do them. And part of the Committee of Safety thing is to identify those local things that are going on in your community that you absolutely have control over if you just come in as a group of people and you face it in force and nip it right in the butt. And, you know, a couple times of that, and then what happens is you build credibility in the community. You know, your local officials aren't going to want to try you so much. So that's why we need to be having these conversations, and we need to be talking to each other, and we need to be talking to our officials. And, you know, I talked to my sheriff early on, and when they were getting federal grants for this and they were militarizing them, and I said, you know, you can't be taking these federal grants because they all come with strings attached. And the string attached is that you're going to sign off your authority in the event that there's a, you know, there's a problem. If there's anything that goes on, the whole thing is about handing off your authority to the feds, for up through the state and then to the feds. And he agreed with me, but what he said was, he said, the County Board of Commissioners, you know, we used to have a Board of Supervisors, and then what they did is they turned it into county legislators. So these guys sit around and figure out what they can do with the county money. And he said, look it, when they don't fund me, then I'm forced to go get federal grants. He said, because I can. And he says, and what they do is, when they know there's federal grants, then they take the money that they would have given me and they use it elsewhere. And so my solution to that, and it's not viable in every place, but you got to have enough people to push stuff like this through, was to force them to make a resolution that before they funded any other office in the county, that the sheriff's office would be funded with county funds, you know, because they collect all kinds of money out of the county, and that the sheriff would be 100% funded through county funds. That he would not have to, you know, that he doesn't have to rely on federal grants for stuff. You know what I mean? That he can function. I mean, we talked to a sheriff that they didn't even give cars to in his county. They wouldn't want, they were using their own cars. And I don't know what happened with that, John. We were working with, that was one of the things we were working on. I mean, that's how, that's disgusting. You know, the constitutional officer, they won't even give him a car. So,
well,
anyway,
they don't recognize him as a constitutional officer.
Well, look at, he's elected, is he not?
He
takes
an
oath of office, yeah, and he's elected. I rest my case. I can say no more. That makes him a constitutional officer. Whether you, you know, I look at, water's wet. I don't care what you say. Water's wet. You know, you can't deny it all you want. I'll throw it in your face. You'll be wet. You know. Anyway.
Well, you know that, and I know that, but the powers that be that manipulate that don't want to.
But when they get water in their face, then they realize, yeah, it's wet. And
yeah.
Up to us to show them that. That look at, we don't buy the lie anymore. Look at, we know that that emperor has no clothes. Don't tell us how beautiful he is. He's ugly. He has no clothes. Okay?
All right, I yield.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next question. You've been unmuted. I don't know. You're in the 415 area code. Where are you from?
Me.
Your first.
It's Jeremiah here with the Northern California area.
Okay.
How you doing?
Good.
Okay. Good. Let me grab my notepad because I had the questions written down here. Model State Militia Statute. You can bet I'm going to be looking that up. Thanks, Brett. Brent, sorry. And then also, there's Bears of South Africa. I'll be checking that out, too.
They're Boers. Boer. I think they're pronounced
the Boers.
Right.
Cool.
And they're here. They have groups here. They're like, they have treaties just like the Indians do. There's groups of Boers that came in, and they had treaties. I don't know that much about them. I should shut up, but I'm telling you, I know that they enjoy a certain status in the government because they do have some kind of treaty, just like the Indians do, that they operate under. But I don't know how prevalent it is today as it was, you know, way back when. But go ahead.
Here's a question for you and for Brent. Pretty fast one here. Have you ever read Modern Money Mechanics?
I don't recall.
I think
that
it's written by the Chicago Federal Reserve.
I might have seen it.
In 2002 or something.
Yeah.
I think.
Well,
I was just wondering.
Yeah, no, I don't.
The point
is
that it breaks down fractional reserve. What fractional reserving is all about, and it basically will go into detail as to how they create money, where people say money comes from nothing. Well, there is a system to creating money, and it all is explained in this book, and I highly recommend everyone go online and get a PDF of it and read it, because it will definitely give you kind of a different perspective as to where the value from the place on the Federal Reserve note comes from, you know. But
well, it's just that they play too fast and loose with the rules is what happened, and that's what happened.
Here's another question.
Money's brought into existence through debt, basically. It's debt. They don't
print money. Well, I'm not looking for an answer, Gerard. I have a different question, a better one for you.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's talk about substantial justice real quick here. Meaning, is that all-encompassing, or is that individualized? And then also, do you guys believe in uniform rules? In other words, are the federal rules of civil procedure, are they uniform? I mean, is there any type of uniformity within the United States law structure? There, that's it for me.
Yeah, obviously, look, there's uniformity. Now, you know, when you talk about uniformity, you know, Are you talking about it in a strict sense where you become like a Nazi with it? You know, yes, we have to have uniform rules so that everybody knows what the playing field is. That's one thing, you know. But when you trying to run a statute and saying in this situation with A, B, and C, it always equals D. That's not the case, because every case has its own merits, you know? So, you know, look, we have speed limit laws. You got caught speeding. Okay, you got to pay a ticket. But, you know, you got your son in the car and his arm is cut off and you're trying to make it to the hospital. You know, there has to be exceptions. Now, so in that exception, and I'm a first responder, I'm a fireman, I'm allowed to drive fast, but I can't kill anybody. I can't do what a normal person would do under the same situation. In other words, if I'm going to come up to an intersection that's busy, just because I got lights and siren on doesn't mean that I could blast through that intersection without regarding anybody else and kill somebody else, because I'm liable for that, right? So you can't say that I'm right every time under a uniform code, and that I have unquestioned, you know, right or ability to do something. You have to understand that at some point there's going to be an exception if it's valid. So I don't know where else to go with that. I'm just saying, you know, everything has an exception one way or the other. And if you get too much stuck on sticking square pegs into square holes, you end up getting in trouble. And actually, then you don't need a human being. You just need a machine.
Maybe Brent could come back in and answer the question about uniform rules as they apply to substantial justice.
Well, I'm sure he knows. He's been in the federal court many times. Go ahead, Brent, have a crack at it.
Well, what I'm thinking is that let me bring up something that happened recently. Maybe somebody saw it. It was in the news. Actually, it was kept kind of quiet. And that was the trial of Judge Moore the other day. Judge Moore is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama. He was brought to trial before the Judicial Council to see if he was fit to continue, because he had issued a memorandum. Some people say it was an order. So the probate judges of the state of Alabama, and some people said that what he said to these probate judges could be interpreted as a command forbidding them from issuing marriage license to sodomites and lesbians. I've read it. I suppose somebody could have took it that way, but what he did say was this. He said the law of Alabama hasn't changed. The state legislature forbids this. That's where the law stands right now. As to the state of Alabama, the U.S. Supreme Court has said otherwise. And as he said at his trial, he said, that was just a few days ago, he said, I would never order another judge what to do. I believe he meant it when he said that. I don't believe he would have. No judge in a common law country has the power or the authority to order another judge what to do. Indeed, nobody in government has authority to order any judge what to do in a common law country. The most powerful indicia of our independence, above all others in government, is the utter and absolute independence of the judiciary, not only from other three branches of government, but from all institutions and organizations of religion. And we don't have that. We don't have that now. In all the rest of the world, all of the judges in those other countries, all of Europe, all of Asia, all of South America, all the world except the English-speaking world, judges, to be a judge is to be educated different than a lawyer. It is to be a part of the civil service ranks, dependent entirely for your pay and your job upon the powers that be. We like to say that's not true in America. God help us if it is. But one of the problems we have is Chief Justice Roberts pointed this out in his annual report, the year 2006. It's hard to believe that man's been on the Supreme Court that many years. That's 10 years already. But in his report, the year 2006, he said, we've changed in America. We've changed from the days of Dwight David Eisenhower, president, we've changed from where we get our judges. We don't get our judges from the practicing bar anymore. Not the most of them. He was speaking specifically about the federal bench. He said, we get our judges from the ranks of government bureaucracies, lawyers that work for the government. That's where almost 70% of the judges sitting on our benches now come. And locally, and you all know this probably if you think about it, in your local rural counties even, not to mention the bigger counties, the accepted unwritten road to judgeship is to be first a prosecutor and then run for judge.
Hey, you know what? You're so right, because right now, Victor Wang is running for office. He used to be a prosecutor for 20 years. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. And obviously, and I have older lawyers tell me, older than me, some, most of them retired now, but things have changed in 40 years. Used to, you could go into court on a criminal case. You can make an argument and may the best case win. Fair play and substantial justice. It's not true anymore. Because if you've ever eaten the king's bread, unless you get weaned off of it, if you've ever eaten the king's bread, if you've ever been fed by the government, if you've ever become a kept man, you remain loyal. You may remain loyal to those that have buttered your bread for you. It's a fact of life, a fact. We're all pretty weak, and there ain't no change.
That's a really cool point, because considering the fact that I grew up in foster homes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, if I have to remain loyal to them, that means I have a duty somewhere down the line to make the system a better place for my daughters and the daughters of other men and women.
It doesn't mean it's right that you're loyal in all those cases, but it means that if you've been fed at the trough, if you've been swilling at the trough, it's hard to pull yourself away. And, of course, when you run for judge, you're still swilling at the trough. And if you're still swilling at the trough, remember, as Scalia used to point this out, he said, get real, man. You want me to protect states' rights? Have you fellows ever stopped to consider who signs my paychecks? Where they come from? They come from the federal treasury. Why would you look to me to protect states' rights? Don't be stupid. It ain't going to happen. Why do we have juries? We have juries because judges work for the very people that are prosecuting the poor guy sitting in the dock. That's why. Have we lost sight of that? Why don't we shout it from the housetops? We act like we're afraid to say it. What's wrong with us? The reason we have juries is because judges are not to be trusted. Period. Why are not judges to be trusted? They're not to be trusted any more than because you can be trusted. You can't be trusted either, by the way. Our national motto is, in God we trust. It's not in judges we trust. It's not in men we trust. It's not in the Pope we trust. It's not even in law do we trust. We trust in the lawgiver, the only true lawgiver, the supreme judge, as our Declaration of 76 says, the supreme judge of the world. If we trust in him, that precludes trusting in ourselves. It precludes trusting in anybody. Oh, I know, we learn to get along. We do have a duty of loyalty to those of like kindred mind. But we have no duty. As a matter of fact, God precludes us from trusting other men. To trust men is to be in fear of men, to be in fear of men. The Bible says, that's what that phrase means, Yerath Yahweh, from the Old Testament. Yerath Yahweh, trust. Fear of the Lord is the trust in the Lord. And we're not to have Yerath Ish or Yerath Adam, trust in men, because the Bible says the trust in men brings a snare. Paul the Apostle says, I don't trust you Corinthians in your evaluation of me. And then he added, I don't even trust myself in my evaluation of me. I trust God. If our minds are focused on trusting and relying on him and him alone, if, that's a big word, all of these problems we're discussing will go away. I don't expect that to happen. But I do expect it to happen in my life, and if I don't, I'm going to have problems. And I hope that you expect it to happen in your life, and if you don't, you're going to have problems. The people that wrote, the men that wrote, the people, there's that word again, that phrase, the people that drafted the Declaration of 76, it was not a declaration of independence. Those words don't appear anywhere in the document. Even the title of the document was added later. That's not the title of the document. It is not a declaration of dependence. It doesn't even take a careful reading to see it was a declaration of transfer of dependence, a declaration of transfer of dependence. From dependence to the King of Great Britain, King George III, from dependence upon him and dependence upon them, the mother country, to dependence upon the supreme judge of all the world. It says it just that way. I don't have to interpret. Why is it? Why? Well, I'll tell you why. Because we're godless, that's why. It is our propensity to be godless, to trust ourselves, to trust our friends, to trust in other men. The jury is one of the greatest statements we have in our country of our motto as Americans, in God we trust. We do not trust the judge. Justice Scalia said that the jury is the only thing that stands between the man that's accused and a lone employee of the state. A lone employee of the state. Judges, why don't they admit it? Why don't they confess it? Why don't they say to the jurors, the reason you are here, ladies and gentlemen, is because I'm not to be trusted. Because men at their best are only men at best, and that ain't saying much. Why don't our judges say that? Why don't they confess it? And if they don't confess it, and if we don't confess it of ourselves and of them, then we'll suffer the consequences. Let's start saying it. We're not to be trusted. No, we're not going to change our country. God, the creator of all things, the supreme judge of the world, will change our country if we let him do it. How do you let him do it? You get the devil out of the way. That's how you do it. How do you get out of the way? You simply do what he says to do. Just simply do what he says to do. And if you're not willing to follow him and carry the flag, get out of the parade, because you can't take the flag from him. He carries the flag. His glory is his, and he will not give it to another. Well, that's a long answer to a short question. I appreciate your question, Jeremiah.
Thank you, Brent. That was pretty good. And every time these judges that bang their gavels and they get a kickback for everybody they send to jail, that's the most ludicrous thing. I mean, how come everybody doesn't know that? I mean, that's something that needs to come out, because right there, that says you can't trust the judge, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, those are the kind of things. Now, I've not seen clear evidence of that. I know people say it. I would imagine it could be true. I know there are cases where judges have gone to jail over things like that, but I haven't looked into it that hard either. I haven't had time, but I do know that all of us are susceptible to temptation, and there have been a lot of judges removed from the bench because they have succumbed to that. So it is there, and every judge is as biased as you and me, if not more so. Listen, he wants to retire. It's our job to inform the judge. It's our job to not speak evil of the magistrates. We're not speaking evil. God has spoken of them the way I'm speaking. The Bible says it. I don't have to say it. All I have to do is point to the book. And all I have to do is point to the laws of nature as we see them in the nature of things. It's not my job to relegate anybody to hell, and I'm not doing that. Matter of fact, I never want to do that. But it is my job to say the truth about mankind. Mankind is inherently evil. How do I know? Because I've seen it. How do I know? Because the Bible says it. And there's nobody that's exempt. I talked to a fellow the other day. I was invited to speak at the New Hampshire Free State Project back a few months back. I talked to an Islamic man there, and he was telling me about Muhammad. And I said, you believe in the prophets of the Bible? He said, oh, yeah, we believe all those prophets. I said, well, those guys had their problems. He said, no, they didn't. I said, what do you mean they didn't? He said, they couldn't be prophets if they had sin. I said, now wait, let me get this straight. You're telling me that Paul the Apostle didn't have sin? You're telling me that Jeremiah and Isaiah didn't have sin? You're telling me that Moses didn't have sin when he recorded it of himself? And he said and pointed out what his sin was? And you're telling me he didn't have sin when God said you sinned and therefore you can't go into the promised land, and he wouldn't even let him cross the river while the whole nation went across, and he died on the other side? You're telling me he didn't have sin? No, he didn't have sin. They couldn't be prophets. He said that Muhammad didn't have sin. That's why he's a prophet. Therein lies the difference, friends, neighbors, and relatives, between us and them. They don't acknowledge the sin of men. Only God can make a straight lick with a crooked stick, and all the prophets of God that are his prophets made that straight lick, and we have a Bible. God did that. They didn't do it. They did it. God did it through them in spite of them. But Muhammad, look at his philosophy. His philosophy says that Muhammad has no sin. And remember, the law of Muhammad is not written in statutes, commandments, and judgments like ours. The law of Muhammad is not written in the Quran. The law of Muhammad is the story of his life, and he records everything in gross detail about how he goes to the outhouse in gross detail and how he makes love or has foreplay with his sex slaves in great detail. And everything about his life from that to everything else is the law of Islam. And they follow him. Why? Because he had no sin, they say. We don't even do that. We don't follow the prophets of God because they had no sin. Paul the Apostle said, follow me as long as I'm following God. He said it just that way, and he said, as long as I'm following God in human form, Jesus Christ. No, Jesus Christ was the greatest prophet. He had no sin. That's right. But we're not holding mankind up. Mankind up. Not sons of God like him, the Son of God. We're not holding them up. That's the difference between us and them. And we need to recognize, and James Madison said, our Constitution works only for this reason. Because we've designed it, as the common law has already done, by the way. They were just briefing the common law of government. They said we designed it so that it would make sure and pit men's selfish ambitions and their wrongness against each other. Against each other. The judicial branch against the executive branch, against the legislative branch. And as long as they're pitted against each other, and as long as they're gridlocked, and we got this from the Scots Enlightenment that came to our country at the same time. We got it from them in this sense. They were smart enough to say, they shouted it. We knew it. I say we. It was part of our common law, but they made a big deal about it. And they said, they invented the word, by the way, gridlock. The Scots-Irish that came to America. They said, we want gridlock. Why do we want gridlock? Because as long as the government's fighting among themselves, they won't be bothering us and taking away our freedoms. That's what our government's all about, is the sin of man. If men were angels, Madison said, we wouldn't need a law and a constitution. We wouldn't need government. But men are not angels. Where are we going to find these angels to govern? There are none. I know some angels are sinless. Some are demons. We call them fallen angels. But mankind is not sinless. What is sin? It is, Trenton Bible says, it is transgression of God's law. I'm quoting John. It says that in the Old Testament too. It's a trespass. Knowing or unknowing, it's a trespass. Maybe witting or unwitting. But it is doing what God says not to do. Even if you think you're doing right, you're doing wrong, you'll pay a price for it. It is a strict liability thing with the maker of heaven and earth. That's why you need a remedy for your sin. But let's recognize what man is. We are not a government of men. For this reason, our common law says we are not a government of men. We are a government of law. Not men. Changing men is not going to help us. Getting Donald Trump in office is not going to change things. No. I want men in that will follow the law. Yes. I don't know that he will or he won't. I know Hillary won't. I don't know about Trump. But I know this. He is as weak and susceptible, if not more so, than you and I. Very much so. And he didn't make his money in a way that most of us would consider honest and decent. Now, we're not voting for Sunday school teacher. I understand that. So I think he'd probably be a good man to support. I'll leave it up to your judgment. But my point is, we're sinners. That's why we have juries. And that's why we have juries, because judges are sinners. And somebody may say, well, why is the jury? Well, how does that work? Then if the jury is sinners too, well, the reason that works is this. As I said a while ago, because a jury of 12 sinners can recognize the particular sin of sinners quicker than anybody else, and there's nobody that wants to lay blame more than a guy that's guilty. And that's what jurymen are. I'm telling you, this is ingenious. By the way, it comes from the Bible. It comes from the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. That's why there are 12 apostles. That's why there are 12 tribes. That's why there were 12 stones. And it goes on and on and on. 12 is a number of government. I've read books about why do we have 12 jurors, people going back in history. They can't find the answer. Well, I got the answer. There's a hiatus. We get lost in the fog of antiquity going back. But it traces back to the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. And 12 sinful men on a jury, they're looking to lay blame. And that's why the jury works. But one man, he's nothing but a biased man. I can't explain it all. I've looked into it. I know some things about the jury, but it's the most beautiful engine of justice ever used among men. And I know they make mistakes. I understand that. I've been in cases, plenty of where they're stacked. the jury is stacked. But even where they're stacked, I've seen them come out on the right side and face of the people that have been stacked on the jury. The jury always has a chance of working. Well, that's enough talk.
Yeah, that's why we need judges that'll let the jury hear the facts. That's the problem. They're throwing out evidence and not letting it come in. They're even afraid to let their stacked juries hear the real story because
that's
they
true.
Know they can be turned. You know?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, you know, this business of gridlock and being jealous of powers, I think that we've lost a lot of that. It used to be like the upper court was jealous of the lower court, so they didn't mind slapping them when you went in there. Now everything is asunder. I mean, the president is picking these guys, and who knows what he has on them. You know, so he's picking the court. I think that this business where they want to protect each other's powers has gotten less and less through the past, you know, 20 years. I don't feel it's as a deterrent as it used to be, you know?
Yes. Well, the evil empire does remain a house divided against itself. They don't like each other. They're jealous, competing, ugly, lustful, beyond belief, and that's what keeps them from actually taking over. They're in it for what they can get out of it, every one of them.
Right. So we have to...
Yeah.
So if we know that, we got to use that against him.
Yes. Yeah. Good point.
Right.
That's good point. That's right. That's right.
Just like when you get some overzealous Homeland Security guy arrested somebody for handing out Constitution booklets, we're not so far gone that the people don't realize that that's ludicrous. He did something stupid, and it begged a response, and they got it. And that's a good lesson for us that we need to be responding to these things. That's what the problem with this country is. Like you said, this, you let something into your house, you're responsible for it. We've shirked our responsibilities, and so now we're reaping what we sowed.
I agree. It's time we cleaned up our act, because if our
exactly.
act isn't clean,
yeah.
that we'll get nowhere.
All right, I'm going to take the next question. I don't know if it's for you or for me, but we'll see what happens. Go ahead. It looks like Bob. You've been unmuted. You're on a VOP dialer. Are you there, Bob? Going once. Twice. All right, I'm gonna go to Veronica in PA. Let me just unmute you. Bob, if you catch it, you can come back in. There's not that many people there, so you'll make it back.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In talking about the judges and the laws, that we're a nation of laws, don't you think it's odd that the judges and the legislators don't realize they're getting paid since 1965, when the silver was taken out of the coin, with a foreign currency? For whose government are they actually working?
Go ahead, Gerard.
Well, I just want real quick. I don't think they even contemplate any of that. I don't even think they're there.
Don't you think that's a good question to ask them?
Oh, they'll scratch their heads, most of them. I think most of them have been so dumbed down they never even broached that thought. I don't. You know what I mean?
Wow. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
They're almost invincibly ignorant in my mind. Ask them. See, they'll probably give you some dumb stares. I don't know.
That's exactly what they do. So, I mean, that's been my experience. So, but, you know, their mind is never the same. So, you know, it might be good to raise the level of conversation to that. Article 1, Section 10, it says right there, you know, and they swear an oath of office to uphold and defend, or however they say it, you know, the Constitution. And how are they doing that when they're adjudicating, you know, foreign-made laws, basically, because they're getting paid with a foreign currency? They're our government, technically.
Yeah, anytime you can crack a little bit of the armor and you lift up a chink, that's what you do. And you don't, you know, that's why these things beg asking, even if you don't get an answer, because you don't know what the result of that is. Because that guy will think about that and think about that, And at some point, the light will crack in, maybe, you know. So it's just like anything else. If you don't, you have to bring it out there and throw it out for whatever it's worth. And
sure.
I honestly don't think they know what you're talking about. Most of them don't even understand that concept that you just laid forth. They're going to think you got three heads. What are you talking about, a farm?
But it was mentioned earlier in the call that, you know, the laws, and I think you mentioned it, Gerard, the laws are written in the hearts, especially of, you know, those people who were there on the day of Pentecost, their descendants. So the thing is that this is a beautiful time we're living in, and there's a remnant that's probably in office somewhere who have the conscience to understand that, know the truth, and the truth will set them free.
That's true, and not only that, even I have become convinced that because the schooling that they give magistrates and different judges and things, after a while you got to ask yourself, they got to know what's going on. They got to know that there's something not right here. You know what I mean? How do they dull their consciences so much? So even because it gets to a point that even if you don't know the particulars, like what you just said, oh, that's a foreign current, well, why it's foreign, this and that, the results of what they're doing are self-evident. The destruction that's wrought throughout the land by their decisions and by what they're doing, after you've been on that bench for so long, you have to know that the consequences of what you're doing is evil. You know, you can't convince me that they don't know that something's wrong. So then when you come in and you make a statement, and many of them, you know, it takes a little while to get there because you're young and you got a new position and you want to please and all this stuff. But at some point you should be getting a bad taste in your mouth. And then all it takes is somebody like yourself to come in and throw a thing out there, down there. And that thing could be the thing that changes that guy forever. You don't know, unless his heart is hardened, and then nothing works. You know, if he's like the Pharaoh, it doesn't matter what you do to him. At that point, he can't receive anything.
I hear you.
So,
okay.
But that's
well,
our
thank
duty.
You.
Yep. You're welcome.
Thanks. Yes, it is. Thank you.
Yeah. Looks like Harley.
Hey.
Harley.
I came across my question again. But while it's on my mind, I just want to let people know that Karen Hudis has sort of gone back and forth a little bit, but she mentioned us in one of her latest posts in the positive. So she doesn't believe that we're out to arrest governors at this point and commit shadow treason.
Well, we've been telling Homeland Security that for a couple of years. They keep saying, you're going to arrest governors or judges? We say, no, you are. But anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
No problem. So listen, I had heard that if you get a written plea bargain agreement, you know, from the prosecutor, that that's technically an extortion note. What's Brent or yourself's sort of piece on that?
Well, I call that a species of patriot mythology, as though every evil thing government does has a legal significance. It only has legal significance if you talk about it like it does. Now, plea bargains go back for 200 years, not in the form we have them now. The plea bargain is part of the evil empire's tools to disarm America, number one. I'll tell you how I think that works. And to make convenience for government, to build the criminal law industry and make wealthy those that have an interest in the prisons, and a lot of people have interest in prisons, a lot of people, and it's big money. But legislation is now written so that you're almost absurdly foolish to go to trial. In other words, I know two fellows recently that they had been clients, and
father, son, and one faced 30 years and one faced 40 years. But, of course, they pled out to a lesser charge, and one of them got a year and the other one got a year in home confinement. If they'd have went to trial, the judge would have sent them to prison for 30 and 40 years. Because the policy of our courts now is, I don't understand this one, I don't know where it came from, but if you make the government prove their case against you and lose, they send you to prison. The judges in the federal system are permitted by law to do that, to come down hard on you. And they even say it, well, you put us through all this when you were guilty. Just because the jury, I was involved in the case a few years back where a fellow was charged with two things. The jury acquitted him of the large charge that carried 8 years and said he was guilty of the small charge, which had to do with a discrepancy on his tax return. And the judge said, well, you're guilty, so you can get, I can see, give you the max. And the lawyer said, now, wait a minute. He had to go to trial to prove his innocence on this big charge, conspiracy against the United States. He didn't have a choice whether or not this other charge came with it. That was the prosecutor's choice. So he had to go to trial. You shouldn't give him a longer sentence and punishment for forcing the government to allow him to exercise his right to trial by jury. Well, the judge cut it down a little, but he still gave him a lot. Here's another point. With those plea bargains and things, you see, it's against our law, most fundamentally, to ever penalize a person for the exercise of a fundamental right. In other words, if you refuse to get on the witness stand during a criminal case and you take the Fifth Amendment, the lawyer, in closing, is not allowed to argue, well, he's hiding behind the Fifth. He's not allowed to bring it up at all. And the courts have upheld that. Well, why is it, then, that if somebody demands trial by jury, which is a fundamental right, why is it that they're penalized for requiring the government to prove their case? But they are. Well, all those things we struggle with, and it's our job to keep saying and start the discussion. Start the discussion about what's right and what's wrong, and how far afield we've come, and how stupid and brainless and absurd it has all gotten. Our courts, how absurd things have gotten in our courts. Judges look at a jury pool, or all sitting in the courtroom, and they say, are any of you biased? Nobody says a word. He ought to dismiss them all for lying to him, because they're all biased, for crying out loud. But if any of them say they're biased, then they get cut. That's the kind of madness. Again, it comes back to, we're not even allowed to be human. And so what do? We begin lying to ourselves about ourselves. Oh, no, no, these jurors weren't. Oh, no, this judge isn't biased over here. He said all these ugly things in the newspaper about these people. He's got pornography, one federal case for the Ninth Circuit. This was in the newspapers. This was in the Sacramento Bee. The chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, federal circuit, had a pornography case in front of him, and it was discovered he had pornography on his computer. Should he have been dismissed from the case? He should have been dismissed from the bench. For not saying something about it, number one. Not revealing his bias. Number two, for just being a scumbag and taxpayers' money having pornography on his computer. Those are the kind of things that are going on. It's up to us to start talking about it and saying it and saying it and saying it. If there's anything they hate, they, the evil empire, the minions of it, the useful idiots, anything they hate, is people talking the truth about what they're doing. Just talk about it casually at home. Talk about it if you're in a group. Talk about it in front of a group. Talk about it on the radio if somebody calls in. Maybe you call in. Just talk about it. Talk about it with your family. Bring it up nicely. Don't try to fight about it. Just talk about it. Isn't there a problem here? If they don't want to talk about it, go to somebody else that wants to talk about it. Well, you always run into trouble. In this world, you'll have trouble, the Bible says. It's going to continue, but we need to be talking about it. That's where it starts. Once you got it in your head, you'll start saying it. You know what will happen next? After you start saying it, you'll start doing it. That's why I said a while ago, don't say things that are untrue. Don't talk about things as though they're true when they aren't. God's the one that gives duties and responsibilities, fundamental ones. Nobody else. Nobody else can take them away. Nobody else can take them away. Don't say that they can. Don't talk like that. Don't give others the opportunity to latch on to your words and think there's something to that kind of foolishness. Don't talk that way. I know it looks like it. I know you're suffering. I know I am too. I have too. But just talk about it like you're free and you're not going to tolerate it. Just talk that way. Because if you don't, then we won't be able to talk anymore. They'll stop us from talking. Does that mean our freedom of speech is gone? No. Our duty remains. Our duty, our right to talk, First Amendment, to not talk, Fifth Amendment. It remains, and we better keep doing it, to know when to do it and how to do it, to obey God. And it doesn't just drop on us. It isn't that the law of God necessarily is written on the heart. It's that the heart is changed, and the heart then desires to know the law of God and wants to learn it, learn the standards. That's why the writer to the Hebrews says, trouble with you fellows is you got everything. You don't know anything. You haven't exercised your senses to be able to apply God's will, God's law, particularly in your life, sharply. And that's the problem. Want to talk about, oh, we know right from wrong. No, you don't. That God doesn't drop that on anybody. What he does drop, I'm quoting John Locke. He's the fellow that Tom Jefferson quoted, probably more than any other, plagiarized him to write the Declaration of 76, John Locke. John Locke said, men don't know the truth. God doesn't drop that on anybody. What he does drop on people at the new birth is the desire to learn it and to feel a little bit and find out. That's why we're responsible. We're responsible to go get it and learn it and then talk about it, guard it, and do it. That's what we need to be doing. Well, that's all I've got to say on that question.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good stuff, and I totally agree. And especially what you said earlier about somebody could be very set in their ways as a judge or whatever, but eventually their humanity is still behind there, and they're going to hear something. And even if it's uncomfortable or a risk for me to bring it up, I'm going to feel at some level it's my duty to bring it up and talk about it like it's truth. If it's my truth.
Well, it's not just your truth. It is truth. It's everybody's. Make sure you got the truth. The only way to get the truth is get it from the man, the God, and the God-man that reveals the truth to humanity, and that's the only place you can really get the truth and know it's pure. The laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, two volumes, the first one unwritten in the nature of things and the second one written in the Bible. That's quoting, of course, again, our Declaration of 76. That Declaration of 76 is packed full. I have friends that want to start a national contest, people memorizing the Declaration of 76 in high school, I thought it was a great idea. I think they ought to be doing it. I think they will. At least maybe get it in somebody's head. They might start talking about it. But the Declaration of 76 is the product of Tom Locke through Tom Jefferson, or John Locke. And John Locke was a student of a fellow by the name of Owen. Owen. He was the greatest Puritan of his day. And John Locke wrote a book on the Bible, a long one. It's obscured and forgotten, of course. Evil empire makes sure they bury what they can. But these men understood the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, and that's what they talked about. And because we're not talking about it, because it's not part of our national conscience like it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, that's why we're in this pickle. That's why. There must be a critical mass of men whose minds are bibbling the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God.
Well, rampant relativism is what they want, and they want a technical discussion that can be techniqued, and unless you go back to first principles, you don't get that. You know, another principle I feel is like if we're already paying their salaries and the rent, you know, the utilities on that building and every piece of paper in there has been paid for, and I go and I don't get any justice, that's theft of services on the face of it. And then here I'm in discovery process, and somebody sends me a disc and they send me a bill. And then, if you try to get into Supreme Court, there's another barrier there. They want you to pay a fee unless you're going to fill out a form and go impauperous. And I just want to know if you have any sort of common sense, common law arguments that I could bring up to say, not only do I feel unable to pay this, I'm unwilling to pay this as an extortion, again, on top of my due process.
Well, I understand your frustration. And not too many years ago, I remember a local county at home, it was $10 to file a case, and now it's pushing $200. That wasn't very long ago. It's hard to get into court. Yeah, most people don't have $200 to spare. And a wise, frugal man certainly wouldn't do it. Taxpayers are paying them. I agree. This is wrong. Now, what can you do about it? Well, it got so bad in the days of the apostles that Paul, writing to the Corinthians, told them, you fellows are fools for going into court to these pagans, thinking you're going to get justice. Forget it. So what did he say to do? He said, you need to be impaneling your own juries. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. You need to impanel your own juries. And that's what Americans need to be doing. They need to be impaneling their own juries at the township level, and they need to be submitting to the finality of those decisions and forget the rest of it. If they don't think they can get that justice in the courts, they have to. The idea of, you know, we're not here. Nobody authorized me to change government, to make change. God put me here, and he gave me the duty to replace the evil empire, not change it. It's not changeable. It is not fixable. It has to be replaced by something better. Darkness is not fixable. It must be chased out. How do you chase it out? By turning on the light. You got to turn the light on, and as the Bible puts it, the darkness flees. But the light fills the darkness. Darkness is absence of light, really. By definition, I understand that. But for purposes of analogy, we're here to replace evil. If we don't replace it, it will continue. Just screaming about it and saying you're going to change it won't work. No, that didn't work. That's their game. They're doing that. Get away from them. Don't fool with them. That's why it says, for instance, it says that evil courts, evil people, evil's always a person. It's never a thing. The things just become the tools of evil, inanimate objects like courts, and weapons and things like that. But people are evil, inherently evil, fundamentally evil. And the only way to get their evil out, and the evil they do, is to push them out. If you're foolish enough just to get rid of them and have nothing to put in their place, they'll come back with a vengeance. That's the law of nature, too. Every vacuum will be filled. Now, that's what we're facing in America right now. There's a vacuum of religion, law, and government in America. Is it being filled? You bet it is. By what? By the evil empire under three prominent labels: Romanism, Talmudism, and Islamic law. Islamism. They're coming on like a vengeance. Same thing's happening in England. And those three forms, those three labels, are all the same thing. All three of them are about dominating and taking. That's all it's about. It's about, there's a lot of sex perversion wrapped up in all of it, all three of them. I mean, look at the Roman priesthood. Look at Islam. You know, in Islam, I've said this before, I'll say it again, Islam, everything's okay, in general, to most Islamic men around the world, as long as you're dominating the other fella. Oh, that's what their lawgiver, Muhammad, did. If you're raping another man's wife, that's okay, as long as you've dominated him, killed him. If you're sodomizing a child, that's okay, as long as it's an exercise in domination and not affection. I know that sounds absurd, but the evil empire is absurd. And if you don't fill the vacuum, if we don't fill the vacuum with the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, then this onslaught will continue to come. And there's no amount of military force that will stop it. I mean, people think that there's a political solution. They think that they just talking about how terrible government is and how terrible Hillary is, that won't change things. What changes things? Knowing the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. You got to learn them. You don't know them. Don't tell me you do. And if you do know them a lot, you can always know them better. So that's why I say you don't know them the way you should. If I had mastered the Bible by this time in my life, I'd be set. I haven't. I've been at it hard for a good many decades, and I haven't mastered it. I still can't remember how to apply this or that. It doesn't come to mind at the right time. I'm learning things all the time, not to mention learning things about the laws of nature. And I encourage you also, you and I both know we haven't arrived. We don't know everything. We're not God. You don't know the laws of nature the way you should. Let's get out and learn them. And once we start learning them, we'll start talking about them. Nobody's even talking about it. Nobody's talking about what the Federal Reserve is doing to our judiciary. Our Constitution says clearly our judiciary, no one is allowed to alter the salaries of federal judges, Supreme Court judges. But the Federal Reserve, by manipulation of the dollar, by inflation and deflation, by booms and busts, control absolutely the money, the value of the money that our justices get. They're not getting anywhere near what they were in real dollars a number of years ago. I know that. Why aren't we talking about that? That's in the Bible, weights and measures. It's all there. All of it. We need to learn it.
Thank you, Brent. That was good. And that's another reason why they may be tempted to make money other ways, too. Right? Okay, well, it's 11:59. Yeah. I think we'll close it up. It was a good call, lots of people. And we'll see you same time, same station next Monday. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Gerard.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks.